After lunch, I hope you had a good break. We're going to get going. We have a tight schedule. The minister has to leave sharply on time. Before I introduce the minister, while the last few people are taking their seats, I want to take a moment to give my thanks and that of Martin Indyk to Ambassador Kim Beazley, not just for his support of this event and his support of Brookings in general, hosted a wonderful program leadership committee dinner for us late last year, but also for his tireless efforts in support of the U.S.-Australia relationship. Kim has become a fixture on the D.C. scene, and the U.S. and Australia are both better off for it. So, Kim, thank you very much. Let me now welcome Julie Bishop, Minister of Foreign Affairs, to Brookings, and it's a particular honor to do so. You all know very well that the minister has played a wide range of roles in Australian government and opposition before assuming the mantle of foreign minister in September 2013. I think it is fair to say that it's been a turbulent year during a tenure which has lasted so far a little less than a year and a half. The minister has had to handle Australia's elected seat on the UN Security Council and the G20, and all, of course, at a moment of turmoil in the Middle East, where once again, Australia has partnered with the United States in dealing with one aspect of that crisis in particular. And I think it's worth highlighting the role that the minister played in negotiations with the Iraqi government in terms of an agreement to allow the deployment of special forces to combat ISIS. The United States has a lot of allies, but there are fair-weather friends and there are foul-weather friends, and the difference is well noted and much appreciated in this city. All, of course, during the same period of time in which we've been grappling with an intensification of geopolitical rivalry, most importantly with Russia's actions in the Ukraine. And the minister drew a lot of attention for the way she handled Mr. Putin at the UN, in the G20, and in particular in the aftermath of the downing of MH17, a role that I think showed not just considerable diplomatic nous, but just frankly plain guts. And while the issues may be more controversial in the bilateral relationship, given Obama's remarks at Brisbane, I wanted to highlight your leadership role on climate issues, including at the Peru summit. The minister has also been very active and energetic on social media among her peers. She's very engaged on Twitter. I hope you found your earrings. No. Those of you who are under 40 got that joke. The rest of you didn't. Bless you. It goes without saying that Australia is one of America's most reliable allies with a long history of cooperation from World War II to Vietnam to Iraq to Afghanistan. And as we heard this morning from Andrew Scheer and Evan Medeiros, a relationship that's been retooled to be central to the management of the contemporary international order and the challenges that we face from cyberterrorism to accommodating and dealing with the growth of China and many facets beyond. So I'm delighted to welcome Minister Bishop to Brookings to talk about these and any other issues. Please join me in welcoming her to the stage.
Good afternoon to friends of Australia, friends of the United States, and thank you to Brookings for the opportunity. The alliance between the United States and Australia is a central pillar of Australia's foreign policy and national security. Today, I will speak on a broader theme, but of relevance to this alliance of two open, liberal, Western democracies. I'll address the importance of the nation state itself and some of the contemporary challenges. For while there have long been predictions of the demise of the nation state, there are new and even more dangerous threats to its continued existence and survival. Indeed, in my first speech in the Australian Parliament in 1998, I spoke about the pressures I then saw facing the state, largely brought about by globalisation, the revolutionary social change sparked by the digital revolution, and this was pre-Wi-Fi and iPhones, the rapid expansion in unrecorded intra-firm trade across national borders, making it harder than ever for states to regulate and tax corporate activity, the shrinking significance of geography and increasingly porous borders for goods, capital and labour. It was my view then that the challenge for the nation state was to adapt, to harness the great possibilities and promises of globalisation. But today, pernicious forces have come to the fore and wield greater power than ever that threaten to undermine the nation state. To globalisation's opportunities, we must now add transnational threats. Foreign terrorist fighters claim caliphates, a medieval construct form of fiefdom that is a platform for further territorial conquest. Groups like Daesh, also known as ISIL, claim territory, engage in extortion and people smuggling, yet impose taxes and purport to provide services. This business model is being emulated by other groups, a franchise of terrorism that can be established in unstable, volatile locations. Transnational crime, the drug cartels, corruption, and cybercrime are also challenging the role of states. I'll leave for another day the impact of pandemic disease, environmental degradation, and financial instability. The challenges we face are borderless, yet the world is still divided into and defined by, and to an extent constrained by, jurisdictions. I believe the nation state, despite the challenges we faced, will persist, overcome, and indeed thrive as the organising unit through which nations realise their values and advance the rules-based international community. I'll focus on some of the main challenges we face, common collective challenges, whether born of globalisation, accident, or ill intent, and discuss how we can respond, working together as nations and individually, each taking our share of the burden. Through our United States alliance and separately with like-minded partners, Britain and France, Indonesia and South Korea, Canada and Belgium and others the world over, we must be prepared to lead and to adapt. The Westphalian system will turn 367 years old this year. It is striking to think that despite the transformation of the world, scientifically, technologically, socially and industrially in that time, and the changes that have taken place within the governance of nations, this system has persisted. It has been modified with international law, norms and organisations continuing to be developed and advancing. Yet many of the basic elements of the system are unchanged. The United States and Australia cherish certain values. Our systems enshrine citizenship and democracy. We believe fiercely in certain things: the rule of law, equality before that law, property rights, individual freedom, democracy. It is the vehicle of a nation state through which we give expression to these values and organise to defend them where necessary. At the international level, it is the system of nation states that has, on balance, been the foundation of humanity's efforts to build peaceful, safe, and prosperous societies. With all its flaws, and some nation states embrace systems, values, and strategies that many of us find shockingly flawed, it remains the case that it is an international system based on nation states that has allowed us to improve greatly the circumstances of much of humanity in recent centuries. Yet today there are serious challenges to the sovereignty of the nation state. Many of these challenges are due simply to change, whether technological, social, economic or political. Corporations, for example, have long been indispensable engines of our global economy and now, in many cases, rival countries in terms of their economic power. Consider this. If you rank the top 100 countries and companies by GDP and revenue, only 66 of those largest global economic entities are nation states. Apple, General Motors, Wells Fargo, Boeing, Procter & Gamble, Microsoft, they're all up there in the top 100 in terms of revenue. In legitimately striving to improve returns to their shareholders, global companies, big and small, structure their affairs and businesses to minimise paying tax while operating within the law. Tax collectors face tremendous difficulty capturing taxes on revenue from their domestic jurisdictions. While such corporate behaviour is understandable, developing countries are estimated to lose between US$35 and US$160 billion in revenue each year because of corporate profit shifting. Now, if all companies paid taxes on profits in the countries in which they are derived, this would largely negate the need for global aid flows or development assistance. Global official development assistance in 2013, for example, was about US$135 billion, less than the upper estimate of lost tax revenue. Now, international aid is one of my responsibilities as Australia's foreign minister, so I can't ignore these facts. But governments and business must work together to achieve more equitable outcomes for developing countries. Continually rapid technological and economic change, whether in the form of the social media revolution or the transition from regional and national to global value chains, will require us to continue to adapt and innovate. Now for the challenges to the sovereignty of the nation state that do come from malevolent actors. Tragically, the past year alone has been filled with violent examples. Terrorism is now more global, more dangerous, more diversified than ever before. Terrorist groups have emerged or grown in Afghanistan, Syria, Iraq, Libya, Nigeria, Somalia, Yemen. Daesh, or ISIL, has declared a caliphate, putting whole villages, towns, cities, and vital infrastructure in Syria and Iraq under its ruthless governance. The Haqqani Network, a group of Islamist insurgents opposing coalition forces in Afghanistan and Pakistan and allied with the Taliban, continues its criminal operations regardless of borders or governments. Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula has claimed responsibility for the tragic Charlie Hebdo attacks and continues to plot terrorist attacks around the globe. Boko Haram has also declared a caliphate and taken control of large parts of Nigeria, and on a day-to-day basis is seeking to impose its brutal governance over the people living there. Offshoot terrorist cells and individuals, the lone wolf, have staged barbaric attacks, including in Canada, France, Belgium, the United States, Britain, and Australia. And we confront the phenomenon of foreign fighters and terrorist-trained returnees. The manifestation of this problem is global. Despite our efforts, terrorism persists as a continuing challenge to the sovereignty of established states. Its perpetrators have no respect for Australia or France, the United States, or Iraq, Russia, China, or any other state. They have no respect for borders, laws, or norms of behaviour. They believe that brutality and violence is an appropriate and acceptable means to achieve their ends. Henry Kissinger recently wrote in World Order that zones of non-governance or jihad now stretch across the Muslim world. When one also takes into account the agonies of Central Africa, where a generations-long Congolese civil war has drawn in all neighbouring states and conflicts in the Central African Republic and South Sudan threaten to metastasise similarly, a significant portion of the world's territory and population is on the verge of effectively falling out of the international state system altogether. Then there are those whose motives are financially rapacious rather than political, as is the case of the international crime syndicates and drug cartels. The effect is still insidious in its undermining of the institutions of state. Crime networks challenge the state by driving corruption, undermining rule of law, and damaging vast numbers of lives. These twin perils, terrorism and organised criminal networks, thrive in places where sovereignty and national institutions are weak. This is why Australia and the United States and others try to build or rebuild stability and state effectiveness in places like Afghanistan and Iraq. We're fighting in the Middle East today for this very reason, to end the opportunities that lawlessness and weak sovereignty provide for terrorist and criminal networks to grow. Narco-terrorism, the financing of terrorism by profits from illegal drug trafficking, is expanding exponentially. Even as nations like the United States and Australia have stepped up the fight against illicit drugs, criminals have used the internet to open new distribution channels and circumvent state controls. And these take time to close down. In July last year, the BBC reported that illegal drug listings online had more than doubled in a 12-month period despite efforts to close down operations like Silk Road. These networks are interconnected and they make big money. Forbes magazine has estimated that Daesh, ISIL, has an annual income of $2 billion. Hamas has annual revenue around half that, about $1 billion. Hezbollah, $500 million annually. International drug cartels collectively make billions of dollars annually. These businesses, and they run like businesses, thrive where sovereignty is weak. The money they make flows around the world, corrupting and undermining states as it's reinvested in further illegal activities. Now, last year, for example, it was reported that Mexico's Knights Templar cartel had diversified well beyond drug trafficking, deriving major income streams from illegal logging, mining, and extortion. Australia is part of a multinational campaign to stop drug trafficking and narco-terrorism. In April last year, HMAS Darwin, a Royal Australian Navy guided missile frigate, seized 1,032 kilograms of heroin off the coast of Somalia. This is one of the largest amounts of heroin ever seized on the high seas. Then there is the realm of cyber. We've long been anticipating the disruptive potential of cybercrime and cyber theft. But recently, for the first time, we've seen a rogue nation state launch a major attack of unprecedented destructiveness against a major private corporation. Presumably, North Korea wanted to coerce its target. Ultimately, it failed. The film, The Interview, was shown and garnered unexpected box office success, but only after significant damage was inflicted on Sony Corporation. The United States' response was swift and crucial in demonstrating that such cyber attacks against any public or private institution cannot be tolerated. Such cyber attacks do not differ greatly from those of terrorism, and like terrorism, they pose a significant challenge to state sovereignty and to our ability to protect the freedoms we should all enjoy. Australia, the United States and others have experienced firsthand the immense damage that can be wrought by cyber thieves operating as hacktivists. Governments face an ongoing battle to secure their networks, the very systems on which we rely to protect the interests of our citizens. I set out these challenges not because they are overwhelming. They are not. I list them to make the case for action. The United States has led collective responses to global problems again and again, especially since the end of the Cold War. It has received its share of credit, but it has also been allocated more than its share of the blame when things have not worked out. This reflects the unique and indispensable role of the United States as the world's superpower, with the largest economy and the greatest political and military might. But the United States should not have to bear alone the burden of solving every challenge that we as nation states face. Australia does not match the United States in sheer heft. What we seek to do is make a serious contribution, at the very minimum, a responsible and proportional contribution to protect the rules-based international system. We are there with our ally and with other partners. I believe that with the benefit of the alliance comes a responsibility to share the burdens, both in material terms and in providing creative and proactive policy input. Australia must face these challenges just as much as the United States. We have just concluded a two-year term on the United Nations Security Council. Australia came to the role in January 2013, and we were determined that elected members could and should make a difference in strengthening the Council's role in the maintenance of international peace and security. Of course, we endeavoured to use our term to support Australia's core national security interests and those of the global order. We aim to make a practical, constructive contribution across the entirety of the Council's agenda. In doing so, we achieve some important outcomes. In July of 2014, we led the Council's response to the shooting down of Malaysian Airlines MH17 over eastern Ukraine, a criminal act that caused the loss of 298 lives from many nations, including 38 Australian souls. Our resolution, adopted unanimously as UN Security Council Resolution 2166, backed both a ceasefire in eastern Ukraine and a full, impartial international investigation requiring all states to cooperate fully with the recovery and investigative efforts. The remains of all our people have been recovered. We're bringing them home, but our quest for accountability and justice continues. We were active on counterterrorism, securing Council agreement in November to strengthen international cooperation on combating terrorism, including tackling the threat of foreign fighters and countering violent extremism. We co-sponsored a resolution condemning all acts of terrorism committed by Daesh and the al-Nusra Front. As chair of three Security Council sanctions committees, we strengthened the Council's response to the threats posed by al-Qaeda, Iran's nuclear program, and the Taliban, and targeting emerging threats including Boko Haram and ISIL. We led Council debate on sanctions reform, boosting engagement from affected countries, enhancing the system's transparency, and mobilising more professional support and coordination from the United Nations itself. We took a leading role in the Council's response to the humanitarian crisis in Syria, securing the adoption of three groundbreaking resolutions within 12 months, requiring the Syrian government and other parties to the conflict to allow humanitarian access to millions in desperate need. We coordinated the Council's work on Afghanistan during the crucial period leading into the transition at the end of 2014 from the NATO-led combat mission to Afghan security control. This culminated in Security Council support for what is called Operation Resolute Support, which will help train and advise Afghan security forces and in which Australia is participating. And we played a leading role in determining the Security Council's response to the findings of the United Nations Commission of Inquiry into Human Rights in North Korea, headed by former Australian High Court Judge Michael Kirby, a groundbreaking, harrowing report which no civilised member of the international community can ignore. With the cooperation of like-minded Council members, the humanitarian situation in North Korea has now, for the first time, been added to the Council's recurring agenda for continued monitoring. Our contribution to global security did not begin with our term on the Security Council, nor does it end there. For example, Australia was one of seven co-authors of the Arms Trade Treaty, the first legally binding instrument negotiated in the United Nations to establish common standards for the international transfer of conventional weapons. The treaty will help promote security, stability, and economic development, including in our Indo-Pacific, our backyard, by preventing the diversion of weapons to terrorists and other criminal groups. Since the treaty opened for signature in June 2013, 130 states have signed it, 60 have ratified it. It entered into force on the 24th of December 2014. Ladies and gentlemen, the ANZUS Alliance clearly sets out our core mutual defence obligations. However, our broad and deep relationship as like-minded nation states leads us naturally to work together to meet head-on these wider threats to peace and prosperity in the context of our rules-based international system. We are both in Iraq today, for example, providing assistance at the request of the Iraqi government to defeat Daesh. Australia is there, alongside the United States, indeed second only to the United States for the size of our contribution, because we have concluded that it is not only in our national interest to prevent Australian citizens from joining terrorist organisations that are seeking to undermine and overthrow the state system, about 180 Australians known to us at the present time, but it is also in the broader global interest for us to contribute to a coalition response. Yes, we face considerable challenges to the sovereignty of the nation state, yet we are not daunted. We will not be intimidated. We can be confident that as countries like Australia and the United States and other international partners are prepared to step up to these challenges, together we will prevail and prosper. Moreover, we can be confident that the nation state will endure as the main institution through which we pursue the prosperity of our people and defend and promote our values and our way of life. Thank you.
Time for a couple of questions before the minister has to leave. Let's just wait to get mic'd up. And if I could just take a moment, when the minister has to leave, if you could please stay in your seats as the minister leaves and waiting for Christine Wormuth to arrive.
I should point out that I'm not leaving for any purpose other than to meet with Vice President Biden, Secretary of State Kerry, National Security Advisor Rice, and Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Senator Bob Corker. So I'm...
It's a light afternoon.
I'm not wanting you to feel unloved, that's all.
We'll go straight to questions. Gentlemen in the front.
Thanks so much, Chris Nelson, Nelson Report. Minister, thanks for a terrific speech and kind of scary. Actually, which I hope is part of your intent, to get people's attention, to make us focus on, my God, what are we going to do? A bigger question and then a more focused question. I get the sense in listening to you that it worries you that while there are many multilateral approaches and responses to all these various challenges you've laid out, that perhaps by definition there's a lack of coordination, and we're all sort of scattered around. And am I right in thinking that? And do you have a sense that maybe it's time to be talking about a world NATO against terrorism or something? Or is that too big a chunk to bite off? You know, I think that was implied in what you're asking. And then a more specific on the U.S.-Japan-Australia alliance, which would fit into that rubric of working together on issues. How do you see the cooperation there working with our friends in China to lower tensions in maritime, not just in the South China Sea, but also in the Senkakus? So thank you so much for a very tough speech.
Thank you very much. There are a number of issues there. I also used our time on the Security Council to chair meetings on counterterrorism and this issue of foreign fighters. And I do point out that Australia has about 180 known citizens who are either fighting with ISIL in Iraq and Syria or are supporting them from Australia. That's known to us. I gather it's a similar number to the United States. And so given the per capita assessment, we clearly have more than our fair share of foreign fighters. So I used the opportunity in the Security Council to also call for a special envoy from the UN for this specific issue of countering violent extremism and countering this phenomena of foreign terrorist fighters. Yes, I am deeply troubled by this phenomenon, and I guess spending yesterday with the heads of your security and intelligence agencies only added to my concern. Again, I see the United States as taking a lead role because of its indispensable position of the world superpower, but the point I'm making is that every one of us, and you know, there are 80 countries around the world who self-nominate as having foreign fighters in their midst. There are 80 countries who acknowledge that they have people leaving their countries to fight under some toxic Islamist ideology in the Middle East. So I believe that there has to be a significant coalition, again, as always, led by the United States, but with countries being prepared to step up and take their fair share of the burden to stem this terrifying challenge that we as nation states currently face. And I do believe that much has been achieved through the Security Council, but much more can be done. I note that China and Russia also nominate a number of citizens as terrorists who have joined the fight in the Middle East. So we're all in this together, and that has to be acknowledged. The second part of your question in relation to the Australia-Japan United States trilateral partnership is a very strong one. It's something that we certainly support. Our leaders have met at the G20. I've met with the foreign ministers, the Secretary of State of both the US and Japan to discuss matters of common and mutual interest, and it's a grouping, a trilateral grouping that I think has a great deal to offer the region in particular. Of course, the United States rebalance or pivot, however one likes to call it, is deeply appreciated in our region in whatever form it takes, whether it be militarily or whether it be through the trade efforts through the TPP. And Australia and Japan are, I think, fundamental to the support the United States is receiving for its rebalance to the Asia Pacific. As far as China is concerned, we work very hard to ensure that our relationship with China is a strong and positive one. We encourage China to be part of the rules-based international system, whether it's in responding to military threats, whether it's responding to the challenges of setting up a new set of rules to apply to trading relationships. We want China to be part of this, and I think during the G20 we certainly saw a more positive approach by China to some of the entreaties from the US, Australia, and of course there was the rather historic meeting between the leaders of China and Japan in recent times. I was speaking with the Foreign Minister of Japan just prior to that actual meeting in Myanmar, and there was a great deal of anticipation but also trepidation as to what would occur. But I think it is a good sign that we can make progress in lessening the tensions that arise from the Senkaku Daiyu territorial claims and also applying to the South China Sea. But Australia, Japan, the United States have a significant role to play in ensuring that China likewise sees negotiation and peaceful means as the only way to settle those territorial disputes. It will take time, but patience is always a good virtue to have in these circumstances.
Thank you, Madam Minister. I have one more terrorism question, if you can stand one more. In the wake of the events in Paris and what's going on in Iraq and Syria, clearly Europe is going through a sea change in how they're perceiving the threat of terrorism and how they're and the tools they're developing for dealing with it. Do you see what's going on in Europe as having important lessons for the Asia-Pacific? Do you see the threat level in the Asia-Pacific and in Australia as on the increase in the wake of Paris? Do you think that we need some heightened vigilance, some changes in how we deal with the issue in the Asia-Pacific region, or do you think this is primarily something in other parts of the world?
Most certainly the events in Paris have focused the minds of a number of European nations as to what reforms they need to implement in order to give their authorities the capacity to better deal with these challenges. I remember 12 months ago when I was here in the US, there was a raging debate in the wake of the Snowden affair as to privacy versus security, and at that point I would suggest that privacy considerations were winning the debate. I'm interested to detect a far different approach 12 months down the track. Of course, you have some legislative issues coming up before the Congress in the next few months, and perhaps that will determine once and for all whether my inkling is right. But nevertheless, in Australia, most certainly, we've made some significant reforms to our counter-terrorism laws, our foreign fighters bills. I now have the capacity to declare off-limits particular geographic locations for Australian citizens. The Al Raqqa province, for example, which is now the headquarters of ISIL, is off-limits to Australian citizens unless you can come up with a very good reason for being there, a journalist, humanitarian worker, family. Otherwise, what's an Australian doing heading over to Al Raqqa province? A cycling tour? Seriously. So we now have some significant powers to do what we can to restrain and disrupt the activities of Australian citizens who are attracted to this murderous ideology that they misguidedly see as some kind of noble cause, which it is not. There is a significant concern in Southeast Asia. It's shared by the countries including Indonesia, Malaysia, the Philippines, of the number of foreign terrorist fighters in their countries. We know that there are a number of convicted terrorists who are likely to be released from jail in countries in our region in coming years. If one assumes that counter-radicalisation and rehabilitation programs have not had the impact that they should, that poses another level of threat. What I have seen, though, is an extraordinary level of cooperation, information sharing and sharing of experiences and lessons learned across the globe. Our relationship with the United States security and intelligence agencies could not be closer. The level of engagement is, I would suggest, unprecedented, perhaps Great Britain as well, but it's unprecedented. And we have a lot to offer each other. But we're also reaching out to countries with whom we might not have even contemplated sharing intelligence at present, and our agencies are as active as yours are in building networks of countries and nations who are being impacted by this terrorist scourge, and countries in the Middle East, in Southeast Asia, North Asia. We are sharing information in unprecedented ways, and I believe that that will go some way to countering this threat.
You're going to have to leave in 1 minute, but before you do, let me ask you and give you.
Oh, you get the last question, do you?
I'm going to steal the last question. Your predecessor was noted for, before he took the job, he said that Australia's top foreign policy objective was to avoid a hard choice between the U.S. security relationship and the Chinese economic relationship. Do you see it as a tension? You have to manage both of these extraordinarily important relationships. How do you view that challenge?
I wouldn't put it in those terms at all, but I suggest that Australia is capable of maintaining more than one relationship. And it's not a question of an economic relationship with one country therefore precludes you from having a security relationship with another. It's a much more sophisticated and mature debate these days. And I believe that as our relationship with China broadens beyond an economic relationship, as the relationship between China and the United States broadens beyond jostling for influence in the region, that we will see that kind of mature outcome that I've always expected would be the case, that there is far too much at stake for countries like the US and China and Australia and Japan to be fighting with each other. We have greater challenges and greater threats that we all face, which was the point I was seeking to make, that we all face as nation states determined to ensure the peace and prosperity for our citizens, that we must face together. And I think the issue of terrorism has brought these nations together in ways that could have been unimaginable even just a few years ago.
Thank you very much for doing this. Good luck in the rest of your program.
Thank you.
Please join me in thanking
the Minister. My name is Brendan Nelson. I am currently the Director of the Australian War Memorial, and I have also served as Australia's Ambassador to NATO and the European Union, Leader of the Liberal Party of Australia, and Defence and Education Minister in the Howard Government. I've been asked to introduce the Undersecretary, which will be a privilege to do so, and I will do so in a moment, but in prefacing the introduction to give some historical context to the Alliance. And one of the observations I've made is that when people, institutions and nations lose sight of what it is in which they believe, it's then that potentially we get into quite significant trouble. A year ago, when I arrived off the plane at Fort Worth, Dallas, and approached the unsmiling customs officer, he did a great job in Homeland Security, Undersecretary. He looked at my passport, he looked at my face, again at my passport, and looked up and he said, "Australian War Memorial." He said, "We need one of them here." And he then went on to say, he said, "My son came back from Afghanistan only 6 months ago, and he was talking so highly of the Aussies. And I said to my son," he said, "every time America picks a fight, the Australians are there with us from the start, and they're the last ones to leave." Now, to some extent, some aspects of that can be contested. Recently, our Australian Prime Minister, Prime Minister Abbott, said that the defining moment in Australia's history, in the defining year, was 1788, the arrival of the First Fleet into Sydney Harbour. Perhaps the next most important year for Australia was 1942, the fall of Singapore. 5 days later, the first of 68 attacks on Darwin. We had a gripping struggle in Isuava, Kokoda, Milne Bay, Coral Sea, Midway, Guadalcanal, three Japanese submarines in Sydney Harbour looking for USS Chicago. There's not a day goes by in my country where privately or publicly we don't give thanks and gratitude for American sacrifice in the Pacific and Asia from 1942 until the end of the war. 103,000 American dead, more than half of them bodies never found. The Second World War had three great consequences for our nation, as observed by Paul Kelly over a decade ago. The first was that it inaugurated the struggle between democracy and communism, which would largely define Australia's subsequent generational place in global affairs and the way it saw itself. Secondly, it laid the basis and the foundation for an emergent Asia, and one with which Australia could deal with equally and with equal respect. But perhaps most importantly in this context, it shifted Australia's defence strategy and outlook away from the United Kingdom toward the United States. For our nation in that context, and indeed perhaps certainly for our region and perhaps for global affairs, the single most important relationship in the world is that between the United States and China. The tectonic plate that's shifting is such that very shortly we will live in a world that we have not lived in since the Franco-Prussian War and the Qing Dynasty. As Paul Kennedy from Yale observed, the world of 1500 is about to end. It's extraordinarily important for our region and for our nation, and indeed for our two nations, that China particularly re-emerges into a rules-based order. The United States' presence in the Western Pacific and our region, enhanced by the Obama-led rebalance, is critically important to our region and indeed to global security. Finally, the Australian War Memorial, which I have had the privilege to be the director of for the last 2 years, is in many ways a repository of the nation's soul. To know a person, to know another country is one thing. To understand it is quite another. The chief of the Turkish Air Force was standing in the commemorative area around our pool of reflection just over a year ago. And in that area, we have the names in bronze of places where Australians have fought and died over more than 100 years. And he pointed to one of them in the Pacific Theatre of the Second World War. And he asked me, he said, "Director, why were Australians there?" And I said to him, General, that's a very important question, because in answering it, in your journey of discovery, you'll understand who we are and what makes us tick. That institution is a war memorial, but it's a monument to peace and at the same time a very tangible reminder that there are some truths by which we live that are worth fighting to defend. It's not until our visitors, our heads of state, prime ministers, defence, foreign and other ministers and dignitaries, and I see Ambassador Bleich nodding as I say this, it's not until they go there and they go through it, and they go through that commemorative area, the Pacific area, through the Hall of Memory, that they understand why an Australia is an ally of the United States. Now, Undersecretary Warmoth is obviously, you'd appreciate, is a person I've only just met. But I have read your CV, Undersecretary, and if you're anything like me, you cringe a bit when people read your CV studiously. I do, because I wrote mine. And I've got to say that my conclusion in reading your CV and other things about you and what I've observed, what you've been doing, and particularly your current role over the little over 6 or 7 months, is that this Undersecretary is a person who has committed her life to public service in every sense of the word, to public policy, to the security and defence of the United States. She's a very strong advocate of the United States having a strong global presence and that being critically important to US interests, as indeed it is to our interests and to global security. She came from the International Strategic Studies Centre and joined the Obama administration in 2009, initially as Assistant Deputy Secretary for Defence for Homeland Security and the Americas, then on to be a presidential aide and advisor, assistant, and the national security staff, then on to Deputy Undersecretary for Strategy, Planning and Force Development. She oversaw the US Quadrennial Defence Review in 2014, and now as Undersecretary for Defence Policy is the Principal Assistant to the Secretary of Defence, the Deputy Secretary of Defence, in the development of US defence and security policy, and also to overseeing the integration of the Department of Defence implementation of defence policy and pursuing US defence objectives. It's my privilege to have you here and for us to be able to listen to you, Undersecretary. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Director Nelson, for that very kind introduction. It's a pleasure to be here this afternoon at Brookings. I worked, prior to joining the Obama administration in 2009, I worked at a think tank just a few blocks away from here for about 5 years, so I'm a big believer and a big fan of the role that think tanks play here in Washington and the impact that they have well beyond Washington, D.C. You know, I think institutions like Brookings, they exercise so much important convening power, being able to bring together terrific, diverse groups for conversations like these. They make such a contribution in terms of scholarship and really have the ability to think deeply about challenging public policy issues, and frankly, sometimes that can be a challenge when you're inside of government. So it's really a pleasure to be here at Brookings and to have the opportunity to talk a few minutes about the importance of the U.S.-Australia relationship, and in particular where I see the security relationship going in the next few years. As I thought about how to frame my remarks, I was really struck by the truly global sweep of the alliance that we have with Australia today. The center of gravity, I think, for that alliance is in Asia, but our work together clearly goes far beyond that region of the world. I think I was able to catch the tail end of the foreign minister's remarks, and I think we share the view that the United States and Australia are really are cooperating on a range of challenges that are truly global, whether it's fighting Ebola in West Africa or whether it's working together to bring stability and security to faraway places like Afghanistan. I just got back last night from Iraq. I was able to go to Baghdad and Erbil up in the north, but I also went to one of our new coalition training sites in Taji, which is a town a little bit north of Baghdad, and we've just started training some new Iraqi army recruits. The training mission, one of the reasons I wanted to go was because that training mission that we're starting there and at three other building partner capacity sites in Iraq is so important because it's going to allow us to work with the Iraqi army to generate enough combat power for them to put together a true counteroffensive against ISIL, working together with the Kurdish Peshmerga forces and also Sunni tribal elements. And I think as everyone in this audience knows very well, Australia is a very important member of the now over 60-nation international coalition that is fighting against ISIL and radical extremism. Australian and U.S. military personnel are working side by side in Iraq, and our two nations are also cooperating on other non-military aspects of the counter-ISIL campaign. So I think it makes sense to talk a little bit about the U.S.-Australia alliance in the context of these kinds of global challenges that we're facing, which include strengthening the relationships that we have in Asia, and then focus in a little bit more detail in where I see the security aspect of the relationship going. As Director Nelson just said, I think very eloquently, the United States and Australia have a very long history of standing shoulder to shoulder in every major conflict really since World War I. And our security cooperation really continues to be a linchpin of stability around the world. That cooperation together is so important. I think when you reflect on the hostage crisis in Sydney just last month and the terrible terrorist attacks in Paris 2 weeks ago, those are really stark reminders that violent extremism, which is just one challenge that we're facing together, it's a truly global, not just regional threat, and it's something that we'll only be successful in defeating if we join the fight together. As I said, the U.S. is leading an international coalition to degrade and ultimately defeat ISIL, and we're really trying to put together a campaign against across multiple lines of effort, not just a military campaign. We're not going to be able to defeat ISIL or Daesh, as people in the region refer to it, solely through military means. We're going to have to disrupt its sources of revenue. We need to stop the flow of foreign fighters. Again, I heard Foreign Minister Bishop take a question on that, and all of us, I know, are concerned about the threat that foreign fighters pose to our homeland. We've got to work together to counter the terrible narrative that ISIL has and also figure out how we can work together to provide humanitarian support to address all of the chaos that ISIL is leaving in its wake in Iraq and Syria. And Australia is, again, a key coalition partner in that effort. I think, as most of you know, in September, Australia committed to send about 200 special operations forces to Iraq to help us with advising and assisting the Iraqi security forces. There are also, I believe, around 400 Australian Air Force personnel associated with the air campaign. And in addition to providing all of that military support as part of the advise and assist and the kinetic part of the campaign, Australia has also provided very essential humanitarian airlift and has been a key part of the effort to resupply the Kurdish Peshmerga. And I can tell you, I heard from every single KRG official that I met with over the last few days in Iraq just how grateful they are for that resupply of their very much needed equipment on the battlefield. The fight against ISIL is obviously going to be a long-term effort. This is not something that's going to end in 6 months. But I think the international coalition that we put together is strong. It's diverse. And I was encouraged during my visit to Iraq to see that ISIL, I believe, is truly more and more in a defensive posture. The momentum of their military efforts has been blunted significantly. They are experiencing a lot of challenges in governing the people that they're conquering. And all of the Iraqi officials I met with, whether they were Sunni or Shia or Kurd or another ethnicity, they were united in their desire to push ISIL out of the country and to regain full sovereignty over Iraq. I think it's worth noting that even as all of this was happening this summer in the Middle East, we found ourselves facing another national security threat of major significance, and that was the outbreak of a very severe regional epidemic of Ebola in West Africa. And here again, the United States was joined by Australia in an effort to respond to the crisis and to try to contain the virus. When it looked most bleak back in September, the pace of the viral infection was increasing dramatically, and the region was really facing a dearth of civilian responders. President Obama directed and authorized the deployment of about up to 3,000 U.S. military personnel to West Africa. And they're working in support of our USAID and several other U.S. government agencies. The Department of Defense brought several capabilities to bear to try to help with response. In particular, we brought capabilities focused on how we can improve command and control in West Africa. We brought logistics support capabilities, engineering support. We brought a handful of our diagnostic labs, and we also focused specifically on training healthcare workers in the how to prevent Ebola and how to protect patients from Ebola if they were infected. We in the Department of Defense focused our efforts in Liberia. Australia was very helpful in providing oversight of a hospital in Sierra Leone, where the United Kingdom was also taking a very significant role. So that was, I think, a very effective demonstration of our cooperative efforts against a major threat. And together we were able, I think, as a group, to really galvanize much more international support to deal with the problem. So we really had a multiplying effect and brought a lot more resources to bear in West Africa, which has gone a long way to reducing the amount of human suffering in Africa and really getting a handle around the Ebola threat in the region. If we turn to Europe and think about the tragic downing of Malaysian Airlines Flight 17 in July, and the loss of 38 Australian citizens, that I think also is another unexpected and stark reminder of how instability that seems to be very far away can have a real impact close to home. And I think Australia's leadership in the recovery efforts there was truly a testament to its ability to respond on the global stage. That was a very complicated situation, and Australia really did a supreme job in that effort. And throughout that crisis, as the whole situation unfolded in Ukraine and the Crimean Peninsula, I was reminded of the strength of our security relationship, because I know General Martin Dempsey, our chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, with whom I work very closely, he was on the phone very regularly in direct contact with Chief Marshal Binskin, and it was very clear that they have a very close and effective working relationship. General Dempsey was very complimentary of the Australian military forces and all that they were doing. I think another terrific example of the cooperation that we have with Australia in terms of global security challenges is of course, our shared engagement in Afghanistan. As we start this new year and look forward to what we're doing, we're obviously focused on a major transition in Afghanistan after 13 years of war in that country. In December, the United States concluded its combat role there, but we are now working to facilitate the ability of the Afghan National Security Forces to take the lead for and really lead the effort to get a handle on their country's security. And I think as this audience knows well, Australia has been playing a key role for years with the United States and coalition forces in Afghanistan. We are just deeply grateful for the sacrifices Australia has made to join us in working to bring stability to that region. As we look forward to the next couple of years in Afghanistan, we're focused on two primary missions. First, with our allies like Australia and other coalition partners, training, advising, and assisting the ANSF forces as part of the NATO-led Resolute Support Mission is going to be a key area for us to focus on. And second, we will also be conducting a separate counterterrorism mission against the remnants of al-Qaeda. And we're really doing that to ensure that Afghanistan cannot be used to stage attacks against the United States or other coalition forces who've been a part of what we're trying to do there. Over the past decade, our allies and partners have been really instrumental in our efforts to achieve a safe, secure, and united Afghanistan. And because of the contributions made by partners like Australia, we've been able, I think, to set the stage now for a responsible transition to a long-term normalized security relationship, to continue building the capacity of the Afghan security forces and the broader government as a defense partner, and ultimately to protect U.S. and coalition security interests in the region. There's clearly quite a bit more work to do, but I think we're on an important We're at an important point in the process with Afghanistan. I think we have a very good path ahead in the next couple of years. I think as the whole set of these examples illustrate, Australia has been a core partner with the United States in addressing any number of security challenges around the world. But of course, again, going back to, I think, the center of gravity in Asia, we're obviously working together on any number of shared interests in the Asia-Pacific region, and I wanted to talk a little bit about the work we're doing there together. I think a number of speakers earlier today talked about the rebalance to Asia-Pacific, which is a major foreign policy initiative for this administration. And part of the reason that we undertook the rebalance to Asia is because as a Pacific nation, we believe that the United States has longstanding interests, and we also clearly have a very robust presence in Asia. And the reason for that is because our national interests are inextricably linked with the continuing development of the economic, political, and security order in the region. And I think President Obama has talked at some length about the kinds of opportunities that he sees in Asia when he last visited Australia in November. In Asia, we see the potential to deepen our partnerships with countries, but also with regional organizations so that we can cooperate more closely and respond more effectively together to shared challenges like natural disasters, but also to counter piracy in the region, to deal with instability, and also, of course, fight against terrorism, which, again, I think we've had some rather blunt reminders is very much a real problem that we will continue to face for the next several years. Because the rebalance to Asia Pacific is really a whole of government initiative for the United States, I just want to underscore that what we're doing militarily is just one piece of it. There's obviously a very important economic piece. I think a number of speakers earlier today have talked about the TPP and everything that we're doing to try to get that across the finish line. But I wanted to talk a little bit about what we're doing on the security side to make sure that we fully implement the rebalance. First, we're trying to enhance the capabilities of our allies and partners to provide security for themselves, but also for the region. And just to give a couple of examples about what we're doing, with countries like Vietnam, for example, we're working to build maritime capabilities. And we're doing that because we think those types of capabilities will help a country like Vietnam be able to enhance its own national sovereignty, but also help it provide an improved ability to provide disaster relief assistance, for example, when that might be needed. We're also very optimistic about enhancing our partnership with India. I think, as people know, President Obama will be leaving for India soon and is looking forward to celebrating India's Republic Day in just a few days. We also are trying to strengthen regional defense capabilities, both those of the United States, but also, again, of partners in the region. So, for example, we've worked closely with the Philippines to conclude an enhanced defense cooperation agreement, and we're also working closely with Japan right now to revise and update our defense guidelines to really reflect, again, a qualitative leap in terms of what we're able to do on the security side with Japan. We're also expanding our relationships with countries like Indonesia and Malaysia. And finally, an important part of what we're doing on the security side of the rebalance is working in partnership with countries in the region to build a cooperative regional architecture based on international rules and norms. This is a really, you know, it's sort of maybe a bit of an unsexy piece of the rebalance, but it's a very important part of the rebalance. And just as an example of what we're doing there, we are playing an active role in bolstering the work of ASEAN, for example, through the ASEAN Defense Minister Meetings Working Groups, which is a mouthful. All of these initiatives that we're doing on the security side, I hope, underscore our strong belief that peace and stability really need to be pursued in partnership with our friends and allies. And again, in this realm, the partnership with Australia is very much an indispensable one. I think if you look tangibly at what we're doing with Australia, a very visible symbol or demonstration of our close partnership is the deployment of U.S. Marines to Darwin. And I know I was at the White House on the National Security Council in 2011, I believe, when President Obama went to Australia to talk about that deployment. You know, we see these, we see what we're doing with the Marines in Australia as a very important development and something that I think is really going to provide a multiplier effect for what we're doing in the region. This year, about 1,150 Marines have come through Australia on a rotational basis. And over the coming years, we are working with Australia to be able to rotationally deploy as many as 2,500 Marines, you know, on a yearly basis. And there are a host of benefits, we think, to this kind of a rotational approach. But among other things, it will keep the footprint, the physical footprint in Australia, pretty light. In addition to our Marine Corps deployments, we also have Air Force deployments in Australia. And between the two of those, we think we'll very much be able to maintain a very high level of interoperability with Australian Defence Forces and be able to enhance the joint ability that we have to respond to crises and, again, to provide regional stability. I think, you know, through those deployments, we're going to have more opportunities for multilateral training and exercises in the region, and just generally we'll be able to enhance our military-to-military engagement. As we've developed these force posture moves and put in place the framework for supporting these rotational agreements, that's been reflected in our U.S.-Australia force posture agreement. And as we developed that force posture agreement, we did so very much coming from a perspective of respect for Australian sovereignty. That was a key consideration as we undertook development of the agreement. And that respect for sovereignty really underpins our cooperation in Australia's Northern Territory. The posture agreement not only gives us a legal framework and a policy framework from which to operate, but it's also, again, a very tangible demonstration of our commitment to regional security and also Australia's tangible support for the U.S. rebalance in the region. In addition to supporting our efforts to expand U.S. presence in the region, Australia, I think it's worth noting, has been playing a truly key role in enhancing trilateral cooperation and multilateral cooperation in the Asia-Pacific region. And that's very important because it strengthens our collective ability to be able to address regional security issues. In particular, U.S.-Australia-Japan trilateral cooperation has very much deepened in the last couple of years. For example, on the margins of the G20, President Obama met with Prime Minister Abbott and Prime Minister Abe, and together they reaffirmed our shared values to include a commitment to democracy, open economies, the rule of law, and the peaceful resolution of disputes, which I think is a theme that you've heard throughout your conference so far. The three heads of state also reaffirmed their commitment to enhancing cooperation in a number of key areas, to include cooperation on trilateral exercises, on maritime security capacity building, on cyber capacity building, and also on peacekeeping. So we're really doing a lot amongst those three countries to build trilateral cooperation, which I think is important. So as we look, you know, as I step back and look at the security side of the U.S.-Australia relationship, I think we have to, as strong as that relationship is, we need to press forward and continue to modernize the relationship. So I wanted to, you know, I think talking to you all today is an opportunity to say, what does that really mean in practice? What does it mean to say we're going to modernize the relationship? In my mind, one of the key things we need to do is to continue to build on the hard-earned interoperability we've developed through what we've done together in Iraq and Afghanistan. Our militaries have operated incredibly closely together in those theaters. They've learned lessons together, and coming out of those two wars, they really have emerged as a highly interoperable combat force, and we want to keep that going. Our force posture initiatives in Australia give us, I think, a key opportunity to be able to maintain that interoperability and maintain that qualitative military advantage that has been so hard earned. Major exercises like Talisman Sabre are going to be opportunities to keep those joint skills fresh and strengthen our mutual capacity to address future contingencies. It's important to really build on the interoperability we've developed rather than letting those skills fade over time. And by keeping that going, we'll be able, again, to address, I think, any kind of future crisis that we might see. Another area of a modernized alliance that I think will be very important is to continue to press forward in the areas of science and technology. Our cooperation there cuts across a number of rapidly evolving fields like electronic warfare, hypersonics, and a variety of initiatives in the cyber domain. For example, I think as many of you know, Australia has purchased a number of high-tech platforms from the United States, such as the F-35, the E-18G Growler, and the P-8A Poseidon aircraft. That kind of technological cooperation is going to ensure that we have a mutual ability to address the kinds of anti-access and area denial threats that we see in that region. Finally, looking forward, I think we have a real opportunity to work together to improve the foundation of regional security in Asia. Australia has always played an important leadership role in that area, but I think this is a place where that leadership role can expand. For example, one forum where we see this already happening is the ASEAN Defense Ministers Meeting Plus. ASEAN countries, as I think some of you know, have formed a number of expert working groups along with partners to try to address important regional issues. And Australia there now is leading a counterterrorism expert working group, and in the past year also led a maritime security expert working group. And in leading those groups, those groups have been very helpful in building the capacity of partners in the region. Ultimately, though, the true test of a modernized alliance is going to be the degree that we can work together to shape regional and global security, looking to all of the challenges that we see in the overall security environment. And to do that, it's going to require us to think strategically about our continued cooperation. And as part of our efforts to try to do that in the near term, we're going to be comparing notes with our Australian counterparts in terms of how we see the strategic environment. We will be coming to that conversation with the defense strategy and plans that we laid out in our 2014 Quadrennial Defense Review, but we're looking forward to talking with Australia as you all go about developing your forthcoming defense white paper. And just as a very tangible symbol of how close that relationship is, in my previous job when we were working on the QDR, we actually have on a permanent basis now an embedded representative from the Australian MOD who is really just like another person on our staff in the Department of Defense. And I think that we've had that kind of cooperation for the last few years, but I think it shows how really at the working level just how integrated our two countries are on the security side. And finally, I'm looking forward to going to Australia in March to talk about all of these issues. It will be an opportunity to check in on the implementation of the force posture agreement. We still have some work to do there. We'll be able to share views on strategic and regional issues, and also, perhaps a bit more soberly, have the opportunity to compare notes about how our two countries are working through a period of greater fiscal austerity and what that will mean for our militaries going forward. So just to conclude, I think it's fair to say that all of the conversations that you all have had today, I think, point out that the U.S.-Australia alliance isn't based on one single specific common threat. Again, as Director Nelson said, you know, you can just think back to the fact that we've cooperated together over a century in every major conflict. Our alliance isn't a Cold War relic. It's not just about Afghanistan or Iraq, and nor is it about balancing China. It's really about the shared values of our two nations, which are much more enduring than any one particular security threat. Our two great countries are committed to a rules-based international order and the peaceful resolution of disputes. We're striving to support international norms around the world, including unimpeded commerce and freedom of navigation. Both of our countries stand for democracy and human rights. We've faced security challenges together for 100 years, and looking forward, I'm sure that we'll see a whole range of new opportunities and new threats. And as I think about all that our two countries have done together and all that we're doing now to shape today's current events, I'm struck by, again, how closely and how well we work together. And because of that closeness, I'm very confident that looking to the future, we will be able to successfully adapt the alliance to whatever may be thrown at us. So thank you very much, and I welcome the opportunity to take a few questions.
Thank you very much, Undersecretary Warmoth. I know you need to leave in just a few minutes, otherwise I will have to go into witness protection program. So we will we'll just take one or two at the most questions. So James Brown, a very solid Australian secretary. This is not a setup. Undersecretary. Yeah.
Thank you. As Secretary James Brown, I direct the Alliance 21 program here at the U.S. Study Center, well, U.S. Study Center mobile headquarters, I guess, at Brookings. I think the question we're all dying to ask you is how it is that you've had 1,100 Marines in Darwin and we haven't seen a single newspaper article for over a year, which is quite an achievement. But can I just take advantage of the fact that you've recently come back to the Middle East and ask you, you know, 10 years on from when our cooperation in that area really started, whether you think the way we approach counterterrorism this time will be different. I guess in Australia we're thinking about whether we need to, you know, how we're going to approach a possible resurgence of terrorism in Southeast Asia particularly. Do you think if we need to collaborate on counterterrorism more intensively in Asia, that we'll do it with a different model this time?
Well, thank you. It's a great question. I think it's fair to say we have to maybe not necessarily look for a different model in as much as we need to add more to the model that we have. I think a lot of what we've done to date in terms of dealing with counterterrorism has been through the military lens. And we've ranged from having considerable focus on direct action military responses using our special operations forces. Over time, we've evolved to more of a mix between direct action and indirect action, where we're trying to build security forces on the ground. But in my mind, what we need to do more of to augment what we're already doing there is to really think about what are the things we need to be doing to getting to the roots of counterterrorism? What is it that is drawing literally 1,000 young men, for the most case, but in some cases women, to movements like ISIL, and how do we get a handle on that? So I think what we need to be doing is deepening not just our military cooperation, not just the intelligence sharing that, again, I think Foreign Minister Bishop was talking about, but doing even more to try to get after how do we counter the ideological message of some of these violent extremist groups. But also, in addition to trying to do more and to do more that's effective in terms of counter-messaging, we also, I think, again, need to be stepping up our game in terms of countering the financing of all of these different groups, getting after their sources of revenue. So I think part of it is not so much shifting to a completely different model, but really augmenting the military model that has had so much focus to having more that's about countering message, about going after the economic side, and also using, obviously, all of our diplomatic tools, again, which I think is trying to get more to the issue of root causes.
Look, we'll just take one more question. This is a prejudice, I must admit. Boeing has been a stunning supporter of the Australian War Memorial, as has Lockheed Martin. So, Stanley Roth.
I'd like to bring you back to the Asia-Pacific region. I think one of the remarkable developments of last year, 2014, was the Chinese push, starting with President Xi, for Asia from Asians, clearly an effort to reduce, if not eliminate, you know, the U.S. preeminent role in the region, and I suspect Australian role as well. And I won't, in the interest of time, go through all the different components of the initiatives that China has taken. Do you think there is a need for a concerted U.S.-Australian response to this, and if so, along what lines?
Well, I think, there, as Foreign Minister Bishop, I think, also said, there's room. This doesn't need to be a zero-sum game. And clearly, you know, President Xi has made a number of comments. I think that's why I emphasize that, for example, the U.S.-Australia alliance is not a Cold War relic. We have a role in the Pacific, a longstanding role, and it's one that we think we need to preserve. But I think we can work together with Australia and other allies and partners in the region to, again, deepen and expand the development of regional architectures to try to promote international norms and to really work to continue to bring China into that international system. I think we feel very confident that the fundamentals of our relationships in the region are very, very strong, and we don't see any potential for being pushed out of Asia. But I think, you know, and again, we don't see the relationship with China as a zero-sum game. There are going to be elements of our relationship with China that are more competitive, but there are also many areas of cooperation with China. And, you know, I think it's fair to say, you know, we had a very positive dialogue with China, for example, about the recent cyber attacks on Sony. So there are any, we had very positive discussions with the Chinese about responding to the Ebola outbreak in West Africa. So there are a number of areas where we have a very positive relationship with China, and I think there's room for many countries in the Asian region. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you very much, Undersecretary Warmoth. We appreciate that very much. And the alliance has always been about capability, intelligence, sharing interoperability and economic security. And we thank the Undersecretary for setting out very clearly how the alliance will be used to face new and emerging challenges, not the least of which resurgent totalitarianism in the form of Islamic extremism, and using the alliance to leverage the multilateral architecture within our region. So at that point, I think we're able to have a tea break. Is that right, Robert? Not that you look as if you need one. And so we'll have a tea break, and then we will return to hear Wes speak to us from Northrop. Thank you.
Events such as this that focus on matters of peace and security, the acknowledgement of the important role of business is overlooked. We are different. We recognise how important business is at a player in relation to these issues, and we're thrilled to have with us today a particularly important player, and that's Northrop Grumman. And in particular, the Chairman, Chief Executive Officer and President of Northrop Grumman Corporation, Wes Bush. You have the lady from down south. Can you please be quiet? You know, just a visitor to Washington, D.C., doesn't know the protocol. Texans, yeah. Anyway, Wes Bush has the most impressive CV. You have his bio in your papers. He's been had these three roles at Northrop Grumman, culminating with chairman in 2011. Held previous senior roles with Northrop Grumman in the space technology area. He seemed to have come to the company through another company, TRW, where he served as president and chief executive officer of their UK-based global aeronautical systems. His background is in that area, and I learned yesterday that he in fact worked for a year in Australia, in or around Alice Springs. Because you're in this field, you know what happens in this area, in and around Alice Springs, that we don't talk about. But we are always pleased to have Americans in Alice Springs, experiencing a little bit of the Australian culture. For those of you who have lived in Alice Springs, you'd know what I mean. It's a unique environment. Wes was educated at MIT and at UCLA. And of course, Northrop Grumman, you know, as one of the major defence industry companies in the world, and obviously particularly here in the United States, and is an important partner of Australia in providing our and supporting our defence capabilities. And I might just tell Wes that something that should please him. Northrop Grumman provided the radar for our airborne early warning and control aircraft, which we call Wedgetail. This is state-of-the-art technology, and in fact this radar, which is affixed to the top of a Boeing aircraft, was so advanced that it was said to be beyond the boundaries of physics. And I thought that was some hugely demanding defence official in Australia that set the parameters for that contract, but was told yesterday it was Northrop Grumman set it for themselves and then realised it was impossible. But somehow or other, they did the job. And the important part of this story is that the first of those aircraft is now operating over Iraq, providing situation awareness for our fighter aircraft that are bombing in our interests, in the interests of the United States, in the interests of people who believe in peace and freedom. And I spoke to our Chief of Defence, Chief of Air Force, only a week or two ago, and he said it was doing a marvellous job. Australia's never had that capability, and so that shows how important Northrop Grumman is as a partner to us. Northrop Grumman is now investing more in Australia, and we're pleased about that, and we look forward to a long and useful collaboration, we being Australia and the company Northrop Grumman. So before, as Wes comes to the dais, I have to read something. It says, "We are pleased to have Mr. Bush here to speak today. In the interest of full disclosure and transparency, we acknowledge that Northrop Grumman is a donor to the Brookings Institution." I think it's a good thing that you're a donor to the Brookings Institution. Mr. Wes Bush.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I was a little concerned where that statement was going, but I was glad to see how it came out there at the end. Well, I really appreciate the opportunity to be here today, and particularly the opportunity to follow such tremendous speakers and individuals who have clearly dedicated so much of their careers and their lives to public service, both Foreign Minister Bishop and Undersecretary Wormuth. It was, for me, sitting here listening to them, just an opportunity to learn myself about a number of dimensions of the relationship with Australia that are so incredibly important, not only today, but as we think about the future. I was asked, as Robert said, to talk a little bit about the business side of the relationship. And we often use the word alliance, and I know we call this Alliance 21. You know, we all have our own context for these things, but I often see the word alliance as sort of the relationships you feel like you need to have. And my perspective with Australia is it's more of a friendship. It's the type of relationship you want to have. And for a long time, I've had the opportunity to understand that relationship and to be a part of it. As Robert mentioned, my first exposure to Australia was actually the very first year that I was married. My wife and I moved to that part of the country, lovely part of the country. I actually love it. I was a young engineer, and my wife, Natalie, was a young nurse working for the government of the Northern Territory, actually. So we had just a wonderful experience. But we really became advocates of this relationship between our two countries. And for us, that coordinate system of friendship is the way that we think about that relationship with Australia. Now, like most friendships, the relationship between Australia and the U.S. really does encompass a very broad spectrum of interests. And defense, of course, has been an area of incredibly close cooperation between our two countries for many, many decades. And the defense relationship continues to be important, and I think will only continue to grow in importance. But it is also a fundamental underpinning of other aspects of the relationship. Trade, investment, all of those things go to that deep connection between economic security and national security. But as has been said earlier, and I thought Lyndon did a great job of really laying it out, the friendship between our country rests on a more fundamental basis of shared values, shared experiences, shared commitments. And as I've had the opportunity to interact with other business leaders and, of course, government leaders in Australia, I've had a chance to see how this relationship has grown and how it continues to mature. And one of the things that I think is an underpinning of that is actually much of what is happening in Australia itself. Australia is clearly a dynamic, fast-growing, and leading-edge economy, driven by so many of the same things that are driving the economy here in the U.S. From energy and resource production to advanced technology, our two countries provide each other with a vast array of opportunities for partnerships. And those partnerships extend, of course, between industries, between government and industry, but also between universities and other important enterprises that have to come together to shape the future that we all are working to create. Now, those opportunities are the result, as I said, of all the things that we have in common, including a deep appreciation of education, as Foreign Minister Bishop said, the rule and power of law, freedom and the free market, and the dominant role of intellectual capital in our high-tech world. Clearly, as we think about the future, I think it's important to put our finger on those common interests and make sure that we actually are using that common language to ensure that we're talking about the same things and we have a view that helps us continue to be aligned on it. And this type of forum, I think, is just the perfect opportunity for such a common, for such a conversation, and particularly because it's a forum where it's easy to bridge back and forth between the topics that serve to address both national and economic security of the free markets that we all work to make sure that continue to go forward. So as I think about where we are in the foundation that we have, we clearly have had many years to build the foundation, but more importantly, we need to be looking forward. That foundation is so important, and we can be glad for it, because the Pacific region is so central to the futures of both of our countries. And it is a region that's under tremendous pressure at many different levels and on many different quarters. And I think it'd be fair to ask how our economic relationship can be expected to cope with the growing security challenges that our national leaders see fit to address, especially in this time of tightening defense budgets in both countries. And I think one important answer to that question would be the same way we've always done it, by falling back on the one thing that has never let us down. And that is our collective commitment to a free market economy that is driven by innovation and technological superiority. If you turn the clock back during the Cold War, our commitment to a market-driven economy and technological superiority was how we managed to outcompete a command economy that was willing to defer the needs and desires of their people in the service of massive defense production. It's actually quite a neat combination, combining free market economy with technology and innovation. It was economic strength and technological superiority that allowed the world's free nations to create a solid defense deterrent while keeping defense expenditures within single-digit percentages of GNP. Now, those of us in the defense industry like the higher single-digit percentages, but nevertheless, it's actually quite a neat trick if you compare what happened here to what happened in other countries that we were competing with. But also, in the process of doing that, the scientific and technological advances that were made eventually translated into consumer value and improved standards of living for all of our people. Quite a tremendous outcome. I think that same market perspective and commitment to technological superiority must now be applied to the challenges of our common interests in the Asian Pacific region and, quite frankly, around the globe. The good news is that those challenges lend themselves nicely to the types of solutions that our partnership has successfully generated by working together for many, many years. As an example of a challenge that we face together, it's the Pacific Ocean itself. As the Pacific Ocean becomes increasingly important, it is the largest single geographic feature on the planet and one that has so many resources and represents, in many respects, both the avenues and the constraints to getting things done, we have to understand what is happening. So an important challenge is staying apprised of the developments on it, above it, and below its surface. In years past, these demands of intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance might have been met by acquiring very large numbers of ships, manned aircraft, and legions of highly trained people. We can't afford to do that. Today, though, we can, together, satisfy much of these demands with far fewer platforms and far fewer people. Whether we are using unmanned airborne and underwater vehicles or satellites or advanced manned air capabilities, as Robert described a moment ago, technology is making this daunting challenge something that we can together reasonably address. And our commitment to technological superiority will be critical to solving any of the many cybersecurity challenges that are facing us that the previous two speakers both addressed. In our increasingly knowledge-based economies, technological superiority will underpin the national and economic security strategy of both of our countries in the future, just as it has in the past. So if that's the case, then surely our alliance will be enhanced through deliberate cooperation in the development of these advanced technologies. Development on both sides of the Pacific, by industry in both countries, contributing to the requirements in both the U.S. and in Australia. So I'll talk a little bit about how that's happening and some of the important criteria for success here. But let me start with an example. Australia's Defence Science and Technology Organisation, or the DSTO, and several of the companies that comprise our collective defence industry have entered into strategic alliances and relationships that promise great advances, advances in technological capabilities, regional security, and in the economic health of an industry that must be allowed to remain economically healthy and vital. But let's keep in mind that as we create these things, the success or failure in achieving the promises of these types of relationships will depend on the policies of the governments that ultimately have control over them. For example, in the U.S., one of the major barriers that we have faced over quite a few decades now have been the export and the import control rules that are often applied even to our closest friends such as Australia. Now, I'm delighted that the U.S. government, and particularly this administration, has committed itself to rationalizing and updating these regulations. It's an example of the very pragmatic policy actions we have to take to enable the two countries to work together effectively, particularly when it comes to advanced technology. Let me stress that the advantages of alliances between DSTO and the defense industry will spill over into Australia's economy and to the U.S. economy as well. In fact, they already are. Several American defense companies have already expanded their partnership and engagement with Australian suppliers, and that expansion continues. Many of those relationships were created through Australia's Defense Material Organization, or the DMO, specifically the DMO's Global Supply Chain Program. That program is showing tremendous progress. It focuses on developing opportunities for small and medium-sized enterprises to export their work internationally. This allows them to support global supply chains like those of some of the larger companies in the defense industry, companies like Northrop Grumman, Boeing, Lockheed Martin, and others. That DMO program is producing results that benefit the defense industries of both countries. Some examples. Farah of Brisbane is now doing machining work on the F-18 Hornet. Quickstep in Sydney is providing composites for the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter. And CEA of Canberra has provided advanced radar equipment for several major U.S. defense programs. But more can and will be done to provide greater access for Australian firms seeking international opportunities. And from the perspective of the companies in the U.S., this provides an incredible capability in the supply chains and furthers our collective technological superiority. Now, you might have guessed from my remarks that I am a big fan of technological superiority, which I believe lies at the heart of any cooperative effort to safeguard the Pacific region and the regions beyond. But there's another theme in play as well. In fact, this theme makes technological superiority possible. It's partnership. It's real partnership, the complicated kind of partnership that requires commitment at all levels. Commitment to the basics of research, to applied research, and to the actual development of products and the availability of those products. Real partnerships have to address the government policy roadblocks that often hinder progress. So we have to have the relationships built to openly and candidly address them. Government-to-government relationships, government-to-industry, industry-to-industry. But also at the center of many of these relationships, we also need to engage the great research universities in Australia and in the U.S. Real partnerships have to be all-inclusive and omnidirectional if they are to bear fruit in the arena of innovation. And because the heart and soul of technological superiority turns out to be intellectual capital, the partnership with educational institutions, I think, is among the most important of all of these. The fundamental commitment of that type of partnership with education must be the creation and delivery of world-class intellectual capital that is able to drive that technological superiority. And the challenge of staying ahead is getting tougher as technology expands around the globe. So the old paradigms and patterns of coming together are really no longer sufficient. Industry, so I'll take this one on our side, can no longer stand to simply be a financial partner with education. We're now seeking new methods and new models of partnership that are producing results that serve a broad range of interests, from those of the students themselves to those of industry and to the objectives that are stated by the colleges and the universities. The defense industry partners are working with colleges and universities to identify the needs of industry, in other words, the highly technical jobs, and to work with the universities to help shape curriculum and to help shape the research activities that will supply the graduates that we collectively need to satisfy those objectives. As with any partnership, success in this endeavor is coming one step at a time. And so, for example, we are making as a company several important first steps to reach out and engage with the universities in Australia. And I'll give you just some of those examples, and we're very public about them, as I would say are our peers in industry, because we want these partnerships to be built not by just individual companies, but by the groups of companies. And we think this is an area where we really need to be coming together. We have a partnership with the University of Sydney, wherein Northrop Grumman is partnering for research and development into small space satellites and unmanned and autonomous aerospace technologies. We're also working with the University of New South Wales and the Australian Defence Force Academy to pursue the development of sovereign cyber capabilities. At Dixon College, we support scholarships and grants in support of science and engineering, and we sponsor such events as the Outback UAV Challenge and the VEX Robotics Challenge. We're trying to find ways and avenues across the spectrum of intersection to not only encourage young folks to go into the STEM fields, but to actually align the educational curriculum and the development of the workforce with the needs that we have, not only in our industry, but also in government, to ensure that we can sustain that technological superiority. The efforts represent good starts, but they're by no means where they need to be to really realize their potential. And I might add that that potential extends to our common non-security interests as well, such as the life sciences and other areas of fast-paced technological innovation. So I'm a big believer in industry's role in affecting these partnerships, and what we seek are others who are as eager to make them happen. More and better partnerships, I believe, are needed to ensure that we're going to be able to produce that technological superiority that our nations are going to need to assure the aspirations of our common interests and our common humanity for prosperity, security, and stability. I think our joint commitment to market-driven economies and that technological superiority really has never let us down so far. And as long as we can stay committed to it, as long as we cultivate it and value it as our foremost national security asset, the struggle to maintain peace, freedom, and the rule of law in the Pacific Hemisphere will be conducted on our terms, not the terms of those who would violate those principles. But we have work to do to make sure we can really achieve that objective. Our current technological preeminence is not ours by tenure or birthright. It came to us through hard work and through commitment and partnerships at every conceivable level of government, industry, academia, and other important enterprise. As in decades past, our preeminence must be cultivated, polished, fed, and argued for if it is to be there when we need it. We must never forget that the pace of technology is moving so fast that once lost, that technological preeminence might never be recovered. There's an old test pilot saying that you've never been lost until you've been lost at Mach 5. The pace of technology really is moving at that speed, Mach 5 and beyond. And given the stakes, we cannot afford to get lost. The watchwords are vision, effort, and ceaseless persistence. But the keys are partnerships, as I said, between industry, government, academia, and others. The objectives are the synergies between our two nations, enhanced economic, national, and global security, and better lives for our peoples. So thanks again for the opportunity to join in this event today, which further evidences the partnership between our countries. I'm glad to be a part of this very worthwhile undertaking, and I look forward to working with all of you to ensure its success as we move forward. Thank you. How about that?
keep talking and it'll all magically happen. Thanks very much for that, Wes. That's very useful. And, of course, for us in our region, there was a time where maintaining a technological edge wasn't so difficult. It's that time was now some time ago.
Oh, yes.
It's changed very, very quickly. So the partnership with the MASS and the research and might of the US and the companies arising out of that, of this culture, is so important to us. Now, questions. We've got a reasonable time for questions. We've caught up time. So who wants to start? I'll start with the woman down here in the third row, and then there's somebody in the second back row on the left.
Hello, my name is Li Yang. Thanks for your presentation. And your company and Defense Department are usually well known about their abuse and waste. And so I just wonder if you are affiliated with some university for technology, I just wonder if you are voluntarily contributed to your dollar or equipment to the university, or you bring the, or ask for more money to your company from university or government, what I mean is the public sectors or taxpayers' money. So I just wonder if you would be able to promote with your money, with your company money, to promote democracy, I mean the real democracy, I mean people got the power rather than your company have a profit over the people.
Right. And who are you representing?
I'm representing the world citizens.
Oh, right. So we've got a question on behalf of the world citizens.
So let me give a little bit of a perspective that I think is important, particularly because I think part of your question went to the relationships between companies and universities. Oftentimes there is a perspective that from a university side of things, that perhaps it isn't the right thing to do to become involved with a company because companies clearly have a profit motive. Companies work on behalf of their shareholders. And might that somehow impede academic freedom or other aspects that are held so dearly in universities? And I think for some period of time, that actually held some universities back in terms of their ability to work with companies. We're seeing much more progressive thinking today across the globe, but particularly here in the U.S. and I would say in Australia, that the recognition is that we actually get to achieving our objectives more quickly, more efficiently by working together. And yes, we have to be careful to protect academic freedoms. And I think every well-known university and every well-considered university has mechanisms in place to make sure that that happens. But we do make more progress in working together. We always do. And particularly where that progress is focused on areas that are so important around the globe, areas that are driving our ability to be secure. You know, the university environment, I think, is probably, if we think about where that stands today, it is a hotbed of innovation. And it's that way because of the relationships that universities have been creating, sort of busting out of perhaps some of the long-held constraints they impose on themselves, the relationships that they're creating more broadly with government and the relationships that they're creating more broadly with industry. So as we go forward, I hope to see that continue to grow. I think it serves all of us very well, both from our national security perspective as well as our economic security.
As Australia, I think it's fair to say, have been slow learners in that regard. Our universities are overwhelmingly public institutions, whereas they've always been prepared to take donations for a long time. They're uncomfortable with the idea of corporates investing in the institutions for corporate interests. But the reality is that you need to build, for a good university, you need to build a resource base. And, and they really can't afford not to now. And those that have learned from the experience have realized that the benefits have far outweighed any downside.
Well, let me also add, though, that I think it is incumbent on companies that engage with universities to bring to that partnership
more than a view of what is going to benefit the company. So as an example, when we partner with universities to focus on workforce development, we know that we're not going to get all of the graduates that come out of those programs. We're doing it from a broader view that that is what is necessary to enable the outcomes that are needed to support the broader set of objectives. Will we attempt to hire as many of those attractive graduates as we can? Absolutely we will. But we go into it not doing a piece of math on specific return on investment. Responsible companies approach it from a broader view that this is actually a part of the role that we play in the broader ecosystem of innovation. And I think it can be very, very productive for both universities and for industry.
Yep, I agree. Question at the back.
Morning, Andrea Shalal, or good afternoon, Andrea Shalal with Reuters. Wes, you've spoken in the past about these export control restrictions, particularly with concern about the export of unmanned vehicles, yes. Unmanned aerial vehicles. Can you give us an update on where you think that conversation has evolved to and whether you think that the U.S. government is starting to see your point of view on that?
Yeah, it has been an interesting evolution over the last 5 years. And, Andrea, I know you've been following this very closely. If you turn the clock back, to about 5 years ago, it was almost an impossible conversation. The notion that we would be exporting not only some of our unmanned vehicle capability, but some of our truly autonomous vehicle capability. The recognition, I think, has grown quite rapidly, and I have to give the leadership of the Department of Defense credit for this. The recognition has grown that if we are not the ones who are going to be exporting it and working with our allies on the future development of that, that technology is already going to happen, whether we're engaged in it or not. So there are many countries around the world that are working on this technology, and we're far better to be in a place where we are working collaboratively with our allies to realize the benefit of those technologies for the alliances than to simply stand back, put a wall around it, and say to everyone else, go see what you can do on your own. So there's been a lot of progress in this. Now, are we all the way through that yet? No, not quite yet. I would say we have great progress at DOD. There is an awakening within the State Department that this is probably the right vector. But there are many parts of the approval process. We've had some very, very good outcomes. Australia's interest and the great support of that interest in large unmanned systems, the Triton program as an example, is one where there's been great support. Clearly, the announcements in both Japan and Korea over the last couple of years and their interest in those similar platforms, great support for that. So I do see a lot of progress. I think we still have some work to do in front of us, but it's on the right vector. I feel a lot better about it now than I did just a few years ago.
It's still difficult for Australian defence, specialist defence industry to sell into the United States.
Mm-hmm.
The rules have been improved, but they are still very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
I actually produce the best ship in the world, but you can't sell it to the Americans. Unless, of course, I build a shipyard in the US first.
Yeah,
now, question at the back on the left. A couple of other examples, you heard yours. Nolco is another one that's gone well.
Yes.
But that has American investment in the,
the DOI well.
Decoy system that's on American ships.
And
came out of DSTO originally.
Very good example of the success.
Morand, small engineering companies also contributing to the JSF project. Question.
Exactly. I want to change the subject just slightly. Lauren Hershey, I was a guest scholar here from the antitrust division back in the 1980s, and we met in the back, Wes, a few minutes or a couple of hours ago now. This is really for both of you, if you can respond. In the United States, there's a lot of discussion about the needs of the education system, and one of those topics that came up was in the State of the Union speech last night related to the idea of 14 years of education, including community college. I wonder if Northrop has a position on this. This is the American workforce. I wonder if at all in Australia, sir, given your responsibilities over the last couple of decades, you already solved the problem and maybe could give some guidance to the United States. I don't know the merits. I'm not taking sides. I'm not an advocate. This is a citizen of the United States kind of question. Also, I'm kind of curious as to the number of jobs that exist here in the United States. under Northrop, and how many of your jobs or employees are overseas, if you know the numbers? Thank you.
Yeah. So let me touch on the higher education piece of it for just a moment. And I have a particular interest in this. I've been a member of the Business Higher Education Forum for many years and chaired it just a couple of years ago. And that question has been right at the center of much of the debate. You know, we all clearly see a great role and a great need for having extraordinarily good research universities and many tiers within our higher education system. And I think both here in the U.S. and in Australia, that's well supported. But we also see, as we increasingly move into an advanced manufacturing economy, which I think is right in front of us here in the U.S. and I think can also be at the doorstep in Australia, we see a great need for individuals who don't necessarily have a four-year education, but perhaps have the benefit of a two-year education, and learning the skills that go with programming, the skills that go with the two-year form of education with mathematics, to enable that next step in our economy in advanced manufacturing. So there's a lot of energy going into, and I know the president made reference to some of this as well, a lot of energy going into thinking about what the two-year schools should look like, what the community college programs should look like, and how that might better prepare a new workforce to step up to this emerging set of opportunities. As a company, we're very supportive of that. We have quite a few relationships, of course, with four-year and more universities and higher education, but we're also developing the relationships with the community colleges and attempting to focus the energy there around the development of that workforce that's going to be so vital to the advanced manufacturing economy. And oh, by the way, those are extraordinarily good jobs. Starting salaries in those jobs can be in the $60,000, $70,000 range. So when you look around the U.S. today, actually, there are a very large number of openings in those positions, and there's not a supply of the talent to fill them. So we're all, I think, well motivated to think about how to get the educational process best aligned to support those needs as we go forward. In terms of the, you asked a specific question about Northrop Grumman. This year, look back at 2014, right around 87% domestic, right around 13% international.
Some of them in Australia now.
Quite a few in Australia, actually.
We won't count that. That's Brent? Well, Brendan answers. I'd say that I think we went through a phase where we forgot the importance of trade schools and technical education. Every community college had to become a university. And so in recent years, we've suffered a shortage of those skills and have had to import labour in the area. I think we're slowly learning now that we need to be more flexible. Technical jobs are important jobs, good jobs, and well-paying jobs.
They are.
Brendan, former education minister.
Thanks, Robert. Global citizen too, and I thank you for the representation I've had today. I'm also a former science minister and former education minister, and just a couple of things, Wes. You mentioned in your speech, which was extremely good, that you're open to, as I understand it, the idea of not just Northrop Grumman, but other defence companies in the industry making a collective commitment to the area of education. In this context, you're talking about universities. So am I right in thinking, for example, you could have Northrop, Boeing, Lockheed, Raytheon, BAE, Thales, and so on pooling? Now, if that happened, that would be extraordinarily good.
Fabulous.
The problem that we've certainly experienced, and Robert alluded to one of them, is that we created a culture in which young people felt that their lives were valued by their educational choices. If they didn't have a college education, they were of lesser value to their families, their country, and so on. And we've made some adjustments in that regard. But the problem that we've had is teachers. The quality of teacher training, the ability, let alone the everything else, for teachers to inspire students at senior primary and then certainly secondary school to pursue continuing education in sciences. Would you, for example, be open to, along with your peer companies, to the idea of developing those sort of career paths which are founded on inspirational teaching And the community model to which we were just referring, in fact, whilst traditionally is applied in a liberal arts context, could easily, I think, at least in Australia, be adapted for the purpose that your industry needs for applied manufacturing. So.
Yeah, Brendan, I think it is just a brilliant remark, and actually one that has action behind it already. If you look at what many of the defense companies are doing today, and I would say that more broadly, the aerospace companies are doing today, over the last decade, we have shifted our focus in K through 12 from largely a classroom focus to a teacher focus. And the idea is exactly as you described it, creating inspiration in the classroom through the teacher, because that's where, you know, for those of us that can recall back through, you know, K through 12, we all had someone who sparked us. And creating that type of an environment where teachers feel that they are both valued and they're given the resources that they need, and they're also given the experiences that they need. And by that, I mean many of the science and mathematics teachers. If you survey teachers over the course of their career, after they have been teaching, in particular in K through 12, for about 5 to 7 years, they often begin to lose a feel of connection to their discipline, whether it's mathematics or science. So many of the aerospace companies have programs where we bring those teachers into our facilities over the course of the summer, and they work as mathematicians and scientists and bring that experience back into the classroom. We also sponsor a number of programs where we select high-performing math and science teachers and expose them to different experiences. We had a program that we ran for many years called the Weightless Flights of Discovery, where we took high school science teachers, trained them how to do something in zero gravity, had them work with their classroom to develop an experiment that they would conduct in zero gravity, and then we put them on one of these flights that flew parabolas, and they would be floating around on the inside of the aircraft conducting their experiment. We would film it, bring it back into the classroom. So I very much resonate with what you're saying, that the focus on teachers really is the point of leverage and the opportunity for us. So yes to collaboration with the companies, and we're doing it actually today, and I think we could be more effective in doing it in the work that we have underway in Australia. And yes to the focus on teachers. I think all of those are home runs.
Question, middle of the room on the right-hand side.
Thank you. John Watts from Noetic Group. I just wanted to touch on some of the points you talked about, technological superiority earlier on. Defence has done a huge amount in recent years experimenting with new technologies and concepts of operation and how to employ them. But there are some even more radical technologies out there that both yours and a lot of other large and small companies have been developing. And I'm talking about exoskeletons, UUVs, autonomous land vehicles, virtual reality. The military can be a conservative organization at times. I think there's a growing recognition within defense circles, both in think tanks and within the Pentagon, of the importance of experimentation and prototyping. And simultaneously, there's a lot of looking to industry to lead the way in innovation. A lot of the things I hear often is, you know, we used to do this very well, but now we're being beaten by Apple et al. And we need to look to them and Silicon Valley to look for innovation. I was wondering if you could comment on that state at the moment and how large defense companies who are innovating, who are coming up with radical new ideas, can help to develop the concepts of operation and the ways to employ those technologies and as we kind of transition to a new form of warfare.
I think it is a really important question and one that goes to the heart of actually much of the introspection that we see within the Department of Defense today. With respect to how to take the innovation that's already happening and more quickly convert it into products and capabilities that are fielded. This is a pendulum that swings back and forth, and having been in the industry now for quite a while, I've seen it move in both directions. We have to get back to a place where there is incentive for more risk-taking in our collective customer community. And that's difficult, particularly in times of greater austerity, because the downside of something not working is felt more greatly. But I have to give Frank Kendall, Undersecretary for Acquisition Technology and Logistics in the Pentagon, a lot of credit for this. Frank has personally taken on the agenda of driving innovation. And to one of the points you made, yes, there is a role for reaching out to the technologies that are popping up in the commercial space, but there is also a role for proprietary defense technology that is, in most cases, actually a bit more advanced and we're able to manage it in a way where we keep the technological superiority for ourselves. Now, the analogy I use, if the technology is available to everyone, it's kind of hard to be superior. So we need to be in a place where we are actually still ahead. And that requires that more innovative capacity to not only develop things in the lab, but actually get them out there and testing them. Unfortunately, in this forum, I can't name them, but I could name for you in the right forum. Every single one of the services is doing this now. They're doing it in different ways, but they are taking this initiative to go and try things more quickly, and where things are working, turn that into product. So I'm seeing energy in this direction, but ultimately we have to give back to the acquisition agencies the authority to fail. You have to be able to fail if you're going to take advantage of innovation, and we've got to get the pendulum reset in that one.
Time for a last question. Because the flip side is that a lot of defense technologies have actually contributed to commercial successes as they've been released.
And yes.
Think of things like lasers and so forth that may have started in a defense lab but now have a huge commercial application in so many ways. Yep. And by the way, if you want to collaborate in advanced manufacturing in Australia, we'll have a talk with you after.
All right. Good.
Another citizen here, Steve Winters. I wonder, I've heard actually talked by Mr. Kendall that you mentioned, and he pointed out the fact that over, let's say, the last two decades, the number of independent defense contractors in the U.S. has gone down radically from maybe several dozen to maybe five, you know, six or seven. What is the impact of that? Because it would seem that the risk, I mean, you get too big to fail, the type of thing. How do you view that consolidation into a small number of contractors such as Lockheed Martin?
Yeah, I think in any industry there is a natural life cycle to the structure of an industry. And as you mature in terms of your capabilities, the consolidations make sense because what it allows you to do fundamentally, if you look at a company such as ours, we're able to manage our cost structure much more efficiently and thereby set aside more capacity for research and development. And that's exactly what we've done in this defense downturn. And we've, like all of the companies in our space, we've had to reduce our headcount, we've had to reduce our footprint. But one thing that we did through the downturn was we maintained R&D. And I think it is a reflection of a very fulsome understanding of what our mission is as an enterprise. So I think there are great advantages to that. You know, I look at the scale of a company like Northrop Grumman. We have about 65,000 employees. Almost half of those employees are degreed scientists, engineers, mathematicians, technologists of one form or another. The benefit you get in having that scale of capability that comes together and innovates is incredible. So I'm actually excited about what we have in our industry today, not just in our company, I'll admit. You know, other companies in our industry are doing exciting things like this as well. So there is a great vibrancy in the R&D part of the defense industry today.
What would be your roughly what percentage would be your R&D budget?
Again, we generally don't disclose that fully. No. Yes.
Well, I'll put the question differently. With the large American defense companies, roughly what percentage?
If you count, I think you should. If you count what our customers are investing in us for development, it's generally 30-40% of our revenues go in that direction, which is phenomenal.
The trouble in Australia is we've tended to rely on government to pay for that. And it's now a problem because if governments are not paying for it.
Well, there is clearly a role for government, but I think there is also a role, as I mentioned earlier, and I should make this remark very specifically. I am excited about the pace of technology development I see in Australia.
Yeah.
You know, when I have the opportunity to get out, see what's going on in the universities, see what's going on in many of the companies that have been launched in Australia, there are some fabulous advanced technology developments underway in the country. And that's why I'm so excited about the partnership. I really see that the coming together of those capabilities is going to provide some great results.
And that seems a good note on which to end this session.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Perth U.S. Asia Center is a junior sibling to the U.S. Studies Center, and we're honored this year to be supportive of and participating in the Alliance 21 project. We look forward to working closely with the U.S. Studies Center going forward in the future iterations of that project. The Perth U.S. Asia Center was established just a couple of years ago, really set up shop just as last year. And as you might imagine from our name, we're located in Perth, Australia, in the far west coast of Australia, with a unique kind of perch and look up into the Asia-Pacific region. The underlying philosophy behind the creation of the center is that you really cannot understand Australia's vibrant and complex relationship with Asia without understanding the U.S.-Australia alliance that underpins so much of that, not just the security alliance, but the standards and norms behind everything, behind trade and freedom of movement, etc. And likewise, it's difficult to understand the U.S.-Australia alliance and relationship without understanding the Asia-Pacific. I think you will note that from our many excellent panels and speakers today, a good chunk of the discussion focused on where the rubber of the alliance meets the road in the Asia-Pacific. And so it's wonderful for us to have a chance at the U.S. Asia Center to work with our colleagues at the U.S. Studies Center to kind of look at that strategic triangle between Australia, the United States, and the issues in the Asia-Pacific, which are of shared interest to both of us. We have, as part of the concluding panel of this excellent day's conference, four absolutely spectacular speakers to help us kind of put the alliance relationship in a context. I think the conference thus far and the Alliance 21 project over the last several years has done a tremendous job of helping us understand that the U.S.-Australia alliance is not limited to just security issues. And again, our discussion through the course of today, focusing on trade issues, on broader cooperation, not just in the Asia-Pacific, but globally, really shows how broad and how deep the U.S.-Australia relationship is. This final panel, however, is a chance for us to kind of draw back and focus really on defense relationships between Australia and the United States, to go a little bit deeper into those defense relationships, and to look specifically at how the rubber meets the road. And so if you look at the title of the panel, it's Challenges and Opportunities for Australia-U.S. Defense Ties in the Asia-Pacific. And as I mentioned, we've got four wonderful panelists that are going to help us think through some of the issues that are before us today. You have their bios, so I won't go into the great depth that would be required. We've got a short panel, and I want to make sure that we give as much time to them to share their views and for you to ask questions. But if I can just go down and let you know who we've got here with us. We have Lieutenant General Wallace Chip Gregson, retired from the U.S. Marine Corps, former Assistant Secretary of Defense for Asia and the Pacific, also has tremendous long experience living and working in the region. We have Lieutenant General Peter Lay, retired from the Australian Army, former Chief of Army, currently Director of National Security Institute at the University of Canberra. We have Mr. Ben Fitzgerald, Senior Fellow and Director, Technology and National Security Program at the Center for New American Security, and the winner of the best beard competition in the
entire country. He's the hottest. It's not much competition up here.
Not much.
Also, surprisingly, I'm not a retired three-star general.
And then finally, we have Robert Hill, who has really been the director for the last years of this Alliance 21 project, remains as a senior advisor to it, and is really no introduction here, a former Minister of Defense and is Australia, and as I've heard in several previous venues, one of many X's as we go along the process and go forward. But I think you agree that we've got a tremendous group. I will start off with some kind of initial questions to help set the context of the discussion, and then we'll reserve as much time as possible at the end for question and answers from you, the audience, and from other previous panelists as we go forward. I'll start off, if I could, with General Gregson. I had an opportunity in my 23 years in Washington, D.C., to have interacted with General Gregson in many different iterations, from his time in Japan to his time working on Korea issues when he was in the Pentagon, to his current iteration, what he's doing right now, and his time as Assistant Secretary of Defense. And there's very few people that have the breadth of experience that you have actually in the region and at the same time back here in Washington working on the broader strategic policies. And so I was hoping you would help us think through the strategic challenges for Australia and the U.S. in the Asia-Pacific region and perhaps particularly maybe touch on the question of interoperability. As someone myself who spent a long time focusing on the U.S.-Korea alliance and the U.S.-Japan alliance, the last year has been a very sharp learning curve for me because on a level of quality and the level of interoperability and the level of intimacy between the U.S. and Australia is by orders of magnitude more than I had been familiar with. You've been responsible for and involved in helping set, you know, the process to kind of move that interoperability forward. I'd like your views on, again, the region and the U.S.-Australia relationship there.
Thank you, Gordon. I feel like I should apologize for my accent. It occurs to me I'm the only person up here without a record of ever having a residence in Australia. But you'll have to excuse my Americanisms here, Peter.
So. I speak American.
Let me list a few challenges and then a few opportunities, and embedded in the opportunities heavily would be the interoperability. One challenge is the war on terror has become the obsession of the 21st century right now. It's a valid challenge. It's right that we counter it. It's right that we devote some time to it because it's something that obviously is very dangerous, has to be managed. But we can't allow it to rob too much intellectual policy and fiscal energy and resources away from the interstate competition and the development of alliance policy and strategy in that context. Another obstacle is a lack of clarity about U.S. objectives and strategy. If you do a mapping of speeches of senior officials, you see the inconsistencies in the objectives listed by officials as they talk about our objectives in Asia. We had a declaration of respect for China's core interest in 2009. We termed them a major security threat in 2012. And, of course, there's a persistent confusion about whatever this new great power relationship is or isn't. It's complex. This is the first time in a modern era that a leading economic partner of many nations, including the U.S., is also a source of serious security concerns. To clarify, U.S.-China policy is that we support the rise and the reintegration of China into the existing international system. We sponsored or we advocated for their accession to the WTO. That's not exactly perceived as a hostile act. But also, we have to be clear about what we're facing. There's a perception in the region that the U.S. has not learned to speak out loud about concerns. We may be being taken advantage of on visits of three separate and different secretaries of defense to Beijing. China's used the occasion to roll out a new stealth aircraft every time that we were there for a visit. And when our vice president was on his way to Beijing through Tokyo, the Chinese used that occasion to declare the new East China Sea Air Defense Identification Zone, and with the attendant difficulties. U.S. has got a declining defense budget is another challenge, and there's a lack of follow-through on the pivot or the rebalance. There are military things going on. Deputy Secretary of Defense Robert Work has been very eloquent and public and on-the-record speeches about what we're doing on the security and on the military side. But things like the Trans-Pacific Partnership and other initiatives must accompany the military activities, or else we risk being perceived as being as militarizing our policy. Opportunities. Japan is different. Japan is changing. New policy and strategy development. They're enhancing their military forces. There's new emphasis on policy initiatives with U.S. and other Asian partners, particularly Australia. And it's the first time that Japan has been able to participate as an active partner in many things on the security side. We have the opportunity to achieve an integration of our military capabilities, not just coordination, but integration. The last speaker was talking eloquently about technology. We have the technology to be able to do this. We can do it bilaterally and trilaterally, U.S., Japan, Australia. We can make greater use of the wonderful joint combined training capability at the Townsville Field Training Area. And by practicing and trying to integrate, we will figure out the material solutions, the technological solutions, also figure out how to train commanders in the very difficult art of maneuvering integrated air-land-sea forces. The JCTC in Australia is one thing. If we can find a way to build a counterpart institution in Guam and in the Commonwealth of the Northern Mariana Islands, we achieve a tremendous capability. With that capability of integrating our operations when we need to, we can enhance both engagement and deterrence. We can achieve a widely distributed, politically sustainable, operationally resilient presence around the Asian littoral that counters the major technological development of pervasive surveillance coupled with weapons accurate at distance. By achieving a widely distributed presence, we present no assailable mass target, but with the integrated, agile maneuver forces covering, again, a wide area, we're able to achieve the defensive conditions that we want. In my vote, these capabilities contribute both to peacetime engagement and capacity building with our partners in Asia, and also contribute mightily to deterrence. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. General Lay, if we can turn to you, looking at those same kind of challenges and opportunities and much of the strategic discussion we've had for this day, what are the next steps in terms of operationalizing the relationship, and particularly the defense relationship?
Can I start talking about the benefits
and
get to the challenges and opportunities? And I think from an Australian point of view, the benefits are enormous, not only in the economic, diplomatic field, as we've heard this morning, but also in the defence field. And I would say that most of the benefits flow Australia's way. It gives us a sense of confidence. It gives us access to a whole range of technologies and capabilities that we wouldn't have, and therefore makes Australia a safer, better and more prosperous place. And as we've heard a number of speakers say, it's a special relationship, so I won't go into those common hopes, values, aspirations, things. But it is something that is very special. But it's also something that requires constant monitoring, and conferences like this are important ways of doing that, steady consideration, and occasionally change and less occasionally repairs. And part of that is because of these enormous changes that are occurring, and we're seeing the emergence of a new way of thinking, which is connecting the Indian and Pacific Oceans, and we're seeing the rebalance to Asia. And I think we're still looking for more of that. But the first thing I'd stress in terms of the challenges and opportunities is geography. As the Centre for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments put it, Australia's in a geographic sweet spot. In their words, we've moved from down under to top centre in terms of geopolitical importance, and we have to cope with that. And we have to cope with that with the fact that our regular defence force is around 58,000. We've got a small annual defence expenditure, and our exchange rate is going south at the moment compared to yours, and that's a bugger if you're trying to have a holiday in America. But around about $33 or $35 billion, and I'm an infantryman, so I don't do sums, but it's something of that sort of order. It's also happening at a time of the pivot and concerns about China, and from an infantryman's point of view, we heard a lot about China this morning. I won't bother you with much more of that, but I will mention an angry Russia, an emerging India, the global scourge of radical Islamists, and what seems to be an inability to find an exit from the Middle East. And so Australia finds itself not only with a view of both the Indian and the Pacific Oceans, and Gordon, you and I were talking yesterday about the different perspectives on defence depending on where you live in Australia. On the East Coast, perhaps more towards Asia, Southeast Asia and the United States. Over in Perth, they look towards the Indian Ocean and north towards Indonesia from there. But we need to be able to cope with all of those changes, and as you've heard, that has Australia operating further afield than we might have normally considered. So in Afghanistan and Iraq, the police force that went off to the Ukraine. And one of the reasons we can operate further afield is because of that alliance with the United States, and the benefits are manifest. Military equipment, for a start. We have access to the best military equipment in the world. In the Army's case, the purchase of the M1 tank. In the case of the Air Force, the Joint Strike Fighter. And our ability to operate in Iraq at a substantial level is because of access to that equipment. The ability to acquire logistics, spare parts, maintenance supplies, ammunition, again, a special relationship brings that about. Access to training and doctrine, and through something called, and I'll call it the ABCA, but Australia, Britain, Canada and America. I think over here you probably call it America, Britain, Canada and Australia. But that's an interoperability forum of great depth and magnitude that's really very important, and it even includes the US Marine Corps now. Intelligence, we heard some of that this morning. Science and technology, we've heard about that. And the ability to operate in these combined operations and do these big exercises at the high level are really important to us. And some of the measures of interoperability, some of you might know the... Who knows the marching tune of the 1st Marine Division? It's Waltzing Matilda, and which is one of our national songs, and I look at that as a real measure of interoperability. The Marines are marching to our tune. I think there's also real benefits to the US, though. We do deliver, modestly, actual military capabilities. We do provide at a political level that flag on the table, which I know is important. Capable staff officers, and not only those deployed on operations, but the deputy commander of the US Army in the Pacific is an Australian two-star general. We've got the deputy J3 of Special Operations Command and various other places, and it used to amaze me when I travelled around the world visiting, Australians would pop up from all sorts of strange places and say, "G'day, sir, what are you doing here?" Well, we're very much integrated, and I hope that our officers bring real capabilities, and also a critical analysis of tactics and techniques and procedures, but also some of the strategies and a bit of a different look at targeting. So I think Australia makes a professional contribution to the alliance, but the benefit does come our way. We're trying to do more, and recent government announcements in terms of capabilities, and hopefully some coming in our next white paper, are important. But we're trying to improve that global reach, looking at the enabling support and strategic reach, some new landing helicopter dock ships. Don't tell the Australian Navy, but they look like aircraft carriers. C-17 aircraft, air-to-air refueling capabilities, and as I've already mentioned, the Joint Strike Fighter. But there are challenges, as there would be in any alliance. And the first one I'll mention is a challenge to Australia, and it's self-reliance. And I think it's an issue. And really ever since Nixon and the Guam Doctrine, where he said, OK, we'll help you, but you've got to look after yourselves, the fundamental tenet of the Australian White Papers since then has been this issue of self-reliance, and generally seen as that we'll look after the defence of Australia without the support, especially combat support, of allied forces, read the United States. Well, to my mind, self-reliance for Australia is a fantasy. Our defence force is now so closely intertwined with the US combat, intelligence, logistics and intelligence systems, we really can't operate without US support. That's a great advantage, but I also think it's a sovereign risk, and it's something that we need to be cautious of. And I'll mention Malcolm Fraser, excuse me, an ex-Prime Minister who wrote in The National Interest, and I think Malcolm went too far on this, but he said that Australia's strategic dependence on the United States has become dangerous to Australia's future. I thought he was wrong also in saying that America is a dangerous ally and that Australia has effectively ceded to America the ability to decide when Australia goes to war. Now, he has taken it too far, but it is a sovereign issue to Australia that we must be able somehow to maintain the flexibility and independence to make some of those decisions, and perhaps at some time say, well, no thank you, not this time. maybe more troops to Iraq in the near future might be one of those sorts of decisions we could take. I'm not going to mention China, so I'll move on to opportunities. I think the opportunities in the Asia-Pacific are manifest to both countries, political, economic, diplomatic, but military cooperation with regional states. We are in a sweet spot as far as geography is concerned, particularly located to some of the world's busiest sea lanes of communications and very important strategic choke points. And if you think back to the closing stages of the Second World War, I look at Australia as in some ways operating as a support base or an aircraft carrier for the campaigns that the United States mounted from the island chain north towards Japan. And I think there's one of the real opportunities. Australia can provide that sort of access, and we're seeing that in terms of the bases, the presence of the well-behaved Marines in the North Ship. They've changed their tune since I knew Marines that closely. But I think we need to temper that with the Australian consideration of its places, not bases. And I know it's in the semantic area, but this is about places, not bases. The Marines, I think, are well established and very welcome in the North. We've had the Osman meetings and we've heard about them. They've talked about increased training and exercises for the United States Air Force and the Navy and potentially over in Western Australia. Let me start to draw to a close to talk about some areas which are, I think, ripe for further development. Cyber, that's going to hurt us all, and we really do need cooperation at the national level, but we're going to need it at the industrial level, we're going to need it at the academic level, so we need to bring a real community looking at the cyber threat together. Space, we all know that space is important to us. I can't contemplate driving in my car with my wife navigating, so we have to have global positioning systems. It maintains my marriage. But if we don't have access to space, we've lost a lot. And we do know that space is a problem. It's full of junk. And Australia has not only the advantage of geography, in that we can see the junk when you can't watch it from up here, but we've also got some very advanced electro-optics and technology that can track this stuff and let us know where it is and let us know what its path around space is. We need to cooperate for that. Terror, we've spoken about, but there must be more cooperation in terror, not only, as the Under-Secretary spoke about, the military effect, but also what are we going to do about this ideology? And it can be approached best by coalitions of countries. Industry, I think, is a bit of a problem for Australia. We've got an approach that's military off the shelf, which I think is right. Much American equipment is fantastic. But that's leaving our industries at home behind and bereft, and we need to look at some program of involving them and including them in global supply chains. Ballistic missile defence, this is not a conversation that we're comfortable having in Australia, and I think we do need to become more comfortable, particularly if we look at some of the US combat systems that are going into our naval vessels. They will become an integral part of ballistic missile defence. And what does that mean to our command and control and the way we operate these systems? And as has been mentioned a couple of times today, the advantages of humanitarian and disaster relief operations. Those who recall the arrival of the Marines in Darwin might also recall that the Indonesian Foreign Minister, Marty Natalegawa, almost fell out of his tree and said, "This is a terrible thing." But then within a day or two, he'd realised that there were advantages, and what he cited as the most important advantage was the ability to operate as humanitarian and disaster relief forces. Asia is pretty much disaster central around about now, and I well remember going to both big disaster events in Pakistan, Bandar Aceh after the tsunami up there. Much of the new relationship and really growing relationship with Japan is because of our support after the earthquake and tsunami up there and the provision of military equipment. But humanitarian cooperation also brings military together at a professional level rather than at a combat level. and I think we need to be looking at that. So in summary, real benefits, some challenges, great opportunities, and something by way of an alliance that makes Australia a better place.
Well, thank you. Ben, I know that you've done a lot of work on new technologies, and we just had a wonderful panel immediately prior to this with Wes Bush talking about the importance of that. I wonder if you would address the role of the U.S.-Australia alliance in setting international standards and norms for the use of new technologies, capabilities, particularly in the Asia-Pacific.
Yeah, I'm very happy to do that. And I think that I'll talk a little bit about capability specifically, but I think all of that exists within the context that the two generals have laid out, I think, quite perfectly. So for me, there are both opportunities and challenges associated with sort of arms racing that we're starting to see. And that's really a byproduct of increased strategic competition throughout the region. We often think about China when we're discussing this stuff. They're not the only actor, but clearly they're the largest and most capable. And I think it's important to distinguish two types of capability that we need to be thinking about. One is existing military capability that has associated norms and behaviors in the international system, but is new to the region or is reintroduced. And I'm talking about aircraft carriers being operated by new countries, the very fashionable big decks that look a lot like aircraft carriers but would never be used for that purpose, only ever going to be helicopters. Submarines, cyber capability, we'll get into cyber in a minute. But those kind of capabilities, we know how they get used. If we were using them in the Atlantic, we already know the rules of the road. But we're seeing that as new actors are bringing them in, they're using them in different ways and intentionally trying to test the rules of the road. And sometimes that's very well thought out. Witness China's decision to float large vessels through various island chains just to prove that they can. That's a smart message. But when we get into some of these newer types of technologies, cyber, unmanned systems, that becomes more problematic. And I think there's a significant risk of miscalculation and inadvertent crisis generation almost. And a good example of that would be maybe 12, 18 months ago, China flew, you may have seen this, but China flew a Predator-size unarmed UAV directly at the Senkaku Islands. Now, it didn't enter Japanese claimed airspace. It peeled off, but the Japanese nonetheless scrambled two manned F-15s to intercept it. The Japanese responded by saying, as a matter of policy, they would shoot down any UAVs that entered their airspace. The Chinese responded by saying that would be an act of war. We should probably figure out how we feel about those things prior to being on the precipice of a conflict. The odds of that actually happening seem fairly low, though, which is frustrating. And we see the same sorts of behavior in cyber, and I think we're going to see that increasingly in space. So given that that's occurring, there's an opportunity here for both the United States and Australia. Now, traditionally, we would seek to manage the acquisition of new capability through traditional means, so export controls, foreign military sales, choosing which nations are able to get access to technologies. Increasingly, we're unable to do that, either through China's homegrown industry and their increasing propensity to undertake their own foreign military sales, or through the importance of commercially available software, which we're definitely seeing in the cyber domain, and will be increasingly important in terms of unmanned systems. So if we can't control the environment or enforce the rules-based systems through denial of access to the technology, we're going to have to do it through the use of our technology and the way in which we export technologies. And we're going to have to lead by example. And I would submit that if other nations in the Asia-Pacific region use UAVs in the way that the United States has been using UAVs for the past 10 years, the United States would be quite upset about that. So we need to be very careful about this. And we also need to be careful about either reasonable or unreasonable claims about hypocrisy from newly powerful nations in the region. So ultimately, we're going to have to think about the strategic issues and the environment that we want, and then how to back that up through the very wise use of capability. Now, as two of the most technically sophisticated militaries operating in the region, there's a lot of opportunity for Australia and the United States to do that. The challenge associated with that opportunity, though, is going to be about capacity. Declining budgets, but also increased interaction with a growing number of increasingly capable other militaries. So we're going to have to think about how we undertake that. There are lots of opportunities in terms of some of the things that General Lay talked about, concept development,
exercises, exchanging offices, sharing staff offices. But increasingly, I think that there's going to be opportunities around phase zero engagement exercising around the use of technologies in pretty specific capability ways. For me, I think this is where I look at Australia's sort of burgeoning amphibious capability as especially interesting. In some ways, the rationale for which we acquired that capability, and General A was heavily involved in that, I think some of those circumstances have changed in the ensuing decade between when we decided to get it and when we actually got it. Nonetheless, it's an important capability set, and I think that it will be helpful for us in the short term, but also instructive for the future. Talking to some of Chip's points about interoperability, it's going to be challenging for the United States and the Navy and the Marine Corps to figure out what level of interoperability do we want around amphibious capability, and then how do we go about making that happen technically, doctrinally, and in terms of training. If we can't figure it out between the Australian Defence Force and the United States Marine Corps, who I think have more in common than any two other fighting forces on the planet, we're going to have challenges. But once we figure that out, we can start to replicate that model. In addition to figuring out those practical considerations about how to interoperate, we need to think about how we're going to use our shared capability in the region. And this gets into slightly more strategic issues, like what's Australia's concept for regional security? How does that tie in with theatre campaign plans on the PACOM side of things? And also, how does that seek to reinforce the rules-based system that we are all big fans of? So we have an opportunity, if we get this right, to use amphibious capability to both demonstrate how a newly acquired big deck can be used in the region, but we can also use that big deck to help project power in a phase zero helpful peacetime method. And if we get that right, that's a template that we can start to think about for more contentious and more complex technologies and capabilities that we're going to have to address. And I think that's going to be about unmanned systems. That's going to be about surveillance tied to strike at range, which we're seeing from an increasing array of actors. The potential for a common operating picture throughout the region, how we will negotiate that, what the value of that looks like, and ballistic missile defense. So I think that these types of elegant solutions are technically possible. In the past, it would have been a nice to have. Increasingly, it's going to be a must have. We haven't done it yet. I think that if we get it right, both of our nations are going to be in a much stronger position and we'll have a more stable region. If we get it wrong, we're going to add to instability in the region, and we really need to be careful about how we manage that and how we align our strategic objectives and our capability in a wise and sustainable fashion. That's it for me.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Robert, if we could turn to you kind of in summation. This has already been a very full panel in terms of issues, and we've had a full day of issues on the table. Would you help us think through some of the policy requirements and policy implications of what we heard thus far?
So I'll try and do it briefly, too, because a number of the things that I would have said have already been said. The policy side is important. We've heard Julie Bishop and the US Undersecretary. You know, their responsibility is policy. Responsibility of the warriors is to fight the war. We purchased those ships, two ships. The first was commissioned a few weeks ago, the Canberra. The second is being finished now, largely because we believe that in any future serious stoush, we would be alongside the United States and it would be part of an expeditionary force. We needed the capacity to transport troops and equipment at much larger scale than we'd been able to do in the past. And so we developed a project to obtain that capacity. But we did have in mind that there would be so many secondary uses for those ships, and you've mentioned the humanitarian one. When we address the tsunami in Banda Aceh, our largest ship was capable of taking equipment to that humanitarian mission. It was an aged American ship that simply couldn't carry the tons. So a lot of the equipment we desired to take was left on the wharf in Darwin. It will no longer be the case with the capacity that we're buying in. And we've done that more generally. You know, I think of the latest mission we're involved in Iraq. I think it's probably Peter for the first time that we were able to basically move our force there and to operate our force relying a lot less on the United States, our principal partner, than we've ever had to do in the past. You know, we're now, we've sent the fighters with our own in-air transport that are the most modern in-air transport, in-air refueling aircraft in the world. There'll be a rival when the US gets its new version of the Boeing aircraft. But anyway, what we've got now, we developed as the first development of the basic Airbus 330 model, and it's now operating well and providing that capacity to take our fighters all the way across the world without having to land. I mentioned earlier our capacity for to support them from above. I remember when I used to, as defence minister, used to go into Iraq during the war when I was minister, we were talking to American AWACS. It was nice to have them above telling us that the environment was relatively safe. Australian forces can now rely on their own capabilities. And I think we've now got the second largest fleet of C-17s in the world after the US, which I think is the best heavy transport. You denying that?
No, I'm just looking at the Air Force bloke down there. Ken, is that right?
Second largest, because we tend to have to deploy over long distances.
Yes, just to get to Perth.
We were one of the and that's a great capacity for a small military like ours. So, you know, we've been very conscious of seeking to keep up at the high end, but it's and I think if I might humbly say, I think the decisions that have been made in terms of acquisitions have been pretty sensible. That's now starting to show. We ordered the air warfare destroyers because we need something to protect the troops that are in those carriers. We have to be able to protect against ballistic missiles, so we faced up to that responsibility. Anyway, I didn't want to talk about that. What I wanted to say is I think probably we haven't said enough today on budgets. Mm. Peter did a bit. We invest a lot less per capita than the United States. Australia's grown prosperous on the United States' investment in its defence as it's played out in the Asia-Pacific region. In fact, all countries in the Asia-Pacific region are now better off because of the US investment in peace and security in the region since the Second World War, although some of them tend to forget it. But it's no good us policymakers just saying, we recognise it, America, and thank you very much. The Americans are saying to us, we expect you to invest more, and I don't think that that's an unreasonable request. It particularly wasn't an unreasonable request when the US was going through difficult economic times a few years ago and we were still prosperous. Pendulum has swung a bit. The new Australian government has committed to invest more in defence, which I would applaud. As things are going right at the moment, it's going to become harder to pay for, so there'll be another set of challenges. But defence is expensive, and most expect to get a free ride, and I think we've got to face up to that reality. Part of that, Peter and I in Australia are involved on a panel that's looking at internal reform of our defence organisation aimed at efficiencies. We're calling it a first principles review, or the government called it a first principles review. What is really essential? You know, what are the priorities? What do you do? There is an ever greater demand on defence forces across the world now. You know, a huge demand in Australia in the last decade has been on in relation to illegal people movement. A huge part of our Navy has been taken up in tasks for which it was never designed or structured. We've talked about humanitarian. When I was Defence Minister, I sent the Australian Navy to the Southern Ocean to chase toothfish pirates. They didn't much like going down there. The ships weren't built for it and the conditions are not good. But what was the story? There was nobody else to go down there and chase the pirates. Mind you, when they got the pirates, they chased them all the way across the Southern Ocean. They felt pretty good about it too. But it's just, you know, so often now, governments, when they're in a fix, turn to defence to help them out in roles for which defence was never structured or funded for. And I think policymakers need to think a lot more about that. There's now a lot more thought about force posture. There wasn't much a decade ago when I was defence minister, and I'm pleased to see that that's happening. I remember talking to the Americans about whether they'd be interested in basing forces in Australia, and the answer to me was, no thanks, it's too far from the action. So I'm still trying to work out what's changed in the last 10 years and the dynamics in the region. But sharing the load, we hope that we're useful for the Marines in providing a useful service from the Marines in Darwin that are working in our joint interests in the region. My attitude would be I'd have a similar view to US ships if they wish to be based out of Fremantle. We provide a lot of support for US Air Force in providing target bases and so forth, but I think we can do more and Australia should do more. If we're not paying as much as the US, at least there are some other ways in which we can help make up for that in being useful. There's been a bit of talk today about strategic policy, and I'm pleased that we are talking about it, because in the end you've got to make the right strategic decisions, and there's not much point having the right tactics if they're not operating to the right strategies. And in relation to our region, the region is changing so rapidly. It's becoming so important economically, but it is very complex, and there's a whole new set of dynamics that weren't there even 10 years ago. As states become more powerful and seek to assert themselves, and a few old grudges are starting to rise to the surface again. To have the right strategic policy in place to address these issues in advance is so important and requires time and investment. And the last area I'd mention is what I call the regional security architecture in the region is starting to be addressed, but it's almost it's not sure to a plan. It's sort of ad hoc. So the East Asia Summit came along. Well, that, for reasons it's not time to go into now, but it wasn't really for this purpose, but it can now be useful in terms of a strategic dialogue at that high level. Also mentioned today was the ASEAN Defence Ministers, the PLUS, which involves us, you, Japan, and China, as a matter of interest, as well as all the ASEAN countries. That didn't exist a little while ago. The new developments with Australia and Japan, the trilateral security dialogue, defence ministers' meetings with Japan, and now what our Prime Minister has called, which I don't yet fully understand, an elevated Australia-Japan bilateral security and defence relationship. Some people are saying, is this a new alliance? Well, if it's not a new alliance, what exactly is it? Australia, for the first time, is looking at the possibility of buying Japanese defence equipment at the sharp end, submarines. A few years ago, Japan not only wouldn't sell us anything, but they weren't allowed to. That's changing so quickly, but has the right policy background been put in place pursuant to which ministers are now going to Japan and starting these dialogues? So I won't go on, but I think it is important to do our best from a policy perspective to understand the big picture and get the big picture decisions right in order that we can best equip and support our forces when they have to do the business on the ground.
Well, thank you. If we've gotten nothing else from today, we've got a great name for a rock band, Toothfish Pirates. Something I haven't heard before. Let me ask one kind of broad question for the entire panel before I open it up to the audience itself. Peter had talked about Australia no longer being down under, but kind of being a geographical sweet spot. I will confess that one of the areas where I've had a real shift in opinion in the last year
is that a year and a half ago in Washington, D.C., whenever somebody would mention the concept of the Indo-Pacific to me, I would mock them. I thought it was a silly academic conceit. It made no sense to me, right? But after a year of living in Perth, on Australia's west coast there, on the Indian Ocean and looking up, being in the same time zone as Singapore, Hong Kong, and Beijing, the notion of the Indo-Pacific makes a lot of sense. It puts Australia at the fulcrum point, you know, in the middle of that very important diagonal. That said, it seems to me that if you think about the change in geography, that sweet spot, and if you think about the context that we've been discussing today and now for several years about the U.S. rebalance towards Asia, a lot of that is premised on the presumption that the U.S. needed to shift its priorities back towards the Asia-Pacific. So it's everything from, you know, looking at the U.S. Navy from a 50-50 split between Atlantic Pacific to, you know, a 60-40 type of split. The question I would kind of ask the panel is there a need for a mini rebalance in Australia? So if you look at the changing security needs of Australia and presuming that the toothfish pirates are not the primary threat, that the Southern Ocean is not the primary theater, that the Tasman Sea isn't the primary theater, but that the Indian Ocean, the North, the West, you know, the Indo-Pacific is really the future of that. Is there a need for Australia to kind of shift strategy, policy, budgets, interoperability to kind of match the U.S. rebalance? So I'll open up that.
Well, I think that I used to mock that expression as well, but when Julie Bishop started using it, I thought I'd better modify my language. But of course, Julie comes from Perth, and she realises that Jakarta is a lot closer to Perth than Sydney. So you have a different geography. But the subcontinent's very complicated, and for years and years we've talked about how we're going to address all these issues that surround the Indian Ocean, but the dynamic economies have been in Asia, and therefore we've kept being drawn back there. Now, that was our economic future. But I think the India scene, particularly under the new Prime Minister, and that is now changing that dynamic very quickly. And see, President Obama's off to India. Australia has a major trade delegation in India now. The Modi visit to Australia was very successful. We're talking about a new strategic relationship with India that nobody had really thought through. Our defence ministers do now meet on a regular basis. We've done some exercises, but it's never been easy. But I think there'll be a much greater focus on India the years ahead. That'll create issues in itself with China, and if China doesn't like us working as a trilateral with Japan and the United States, they'll be even more unhappy if we're working with India as well. In fact, there was a quadrilateral security dialogue established, but our then Prime Minister Rudd withdrew it from us because he thought it was upsetting to China. But I can sort of see us heading back in that direction in the years ahead, and that will set a whole new set of dynamics.
Peter?
We heard mention a couple of times this morning of the rebalance and the force posture review in Australia. There has been a force posture review. I don't think much has come of it. There's a real sense of inertia in our bases in Australia, and for those who don't know Australia all that well, the majority of the population is in the southeast corner, and that's where the majority of our bases are and have been historically. For the Navy, Sydney, and if you ever think the Navy's moving out of Sydney, it's not going to happen. But we do have half of the Navy basically in Sydney and the other half in Perth, and so I think there's a balance there. The Army over a period of time has moved from the southeast to the north, and the majority of the Army combat force is north of the Tropic of Capricorn, which is sort of Brisbane, Townsville, Darwin. It's a difficult area to operate in. It brings strategic advantages because it's an empty part of Australia up in the north, and we went through a mantra in the 50s with immigration, populate or perish. We need to essentially claim that part. It's a very difficult part because it's in the monsoonal belt, and you can only train up there for really half of the year. It's very uncomfortable, so the Marines are welcome to it.
Yeah.
I think one thing that's going will exercise a full structure pull is going to be the resources in the northwest of Australia. Enormous iron ore deposits, and it's where a lot of the LNG gas will come from as well. And it's essentially fly-in, fly-out towns. They're very small population. I'm not sure we need to excuse me, have people on the ground claiming it. We need to have the strategic reach internally in Australia to be able to get there and look after it and respond to it. So I think there's a lot of inertia in our basin, but there will be some adjustment around the edges, particularly looking at the multitude of bases, and we're headed towards fewer, larger super bases, which aid not only cost, but also retention of soldiers and sailors and airmen, and their ability to be able to have a family, keep them in the one area, wives, employments, and those social amenity sorts of things. Some changes, not to be mostly shift to the northwest.
Thank you. I mean, the one thing that I would add from a capability perspective is if you think about Australia's strategic circumstance today and into the future and what we needed, and if you removed two impossible things, our history and our culture, military culture, we would have a completely different defence force. It would make sense based on our location, the size of our population, the size of our geography, the relatively high levels of capital and technology and smart people we have access to. We would go heavily unmanned, heavily air and sea and undersea, but that's not the type of defence force we have. So the question for me is, who should we be in the 21st century, and how do we develop that over time? Because we can't ignore our history and culture, but I think that the change that we're going through is sufficiently significant that we're going to have to make some of those changes, and I think that'll be a big challenge for us over the next 30 to 40 years.
I'll just add one anecdote on that, too. During the search for MH370, it was quite jarring to kind of fly into Perth Airport and see all these Chinese airplanes lined up there at the airport itself. And the notion of the Indo-Pacific really isn't just about the rise of India. The Chinese actually floated, I think, three or four vessels, 1,000 kilometers off the coast of Western Australia and kept them there for several months. So they're very much in the Indian Ocean in a very serious way right now, as are the resources. So, Jim.
If I could add one point on this, where the bases are, as Peter said, matter somewhat, but what the capabilities are matters a lot more. For instance, Talisman Sabre 2007, the Australians, to their great credit, took a greenfield area, the Bradshaw training area, the one that Peter says floods every 6 months, and built a C-17 capable 8,000-foot airfield in less than 30 days. And the graduation exercise was one of a U.S. C-17 and an Australian C-17 landing. So it matters somewhat where the forces are, but it matters more if you have the capability, both technology and doctrine, to be able to move forces around quickly to get them to where they need to be. And the Australians need to take more credit for their ability to take a 58,000-person force and cover the continent that you have in rapid fashion.
Fantastic. Well, wonderful. We have about 20 minutes for questions from the audience, so go ahead, please. The lady back there with your hand raised, please, right there.
Thank you. Nalanthi Samaranayake from CNA Corporation. I have a question for the panel about one of the recommendations in the report about a U.S.-Australia ASW Anti-Submarine Warfare Center of Excellence. I just wanted to get the panel's thoughts on, the thinking about setting this up and potential reactions from China, for example. Minister Hill, your comment about the quadrilateral and Prime Minister Rudd pulling out of that due to some of this feeling that it was anti-China. Just wanted to get your thoughts about such a center of excellence. Thanks.
Robert, want to start with you on that?
I think we were addressed. This is a report we put out last year after the first 3 years. And we drew attention to the fact that anti-submarine warfare capabilities in Australia had been run down somewhat. And, you know, I'm not a military person, but I was always taught that the best way to address a submarine threat is through another submarine. We have a fleet of submarines that are now moving towards the end of their tenure as well, and that's going to require to replace them with a new generation of submarines. It's going to require a huge investment, largest investment we've ever made in this area. And getting it, we think it's still important, not only just in that narrow sense, but it, if you do think that Australia having a capability that is complementary to that of the United States, then a submarine that complements the US, which would be a conventional submarine, which complements the US nuclear submarines, the smaller conventional submarine being able to do some things that the American submarines can't do, it becomes quite important. So, anyway, we were pointing out that we saw these as areas that needed to be addressed, you know, within the budget challenges that we face.
I'd say that submarines are a really very capable psychological and physical weapon. Not only are they good for anti-submarine warfare, but for anti-convoy warfare and, as we know, gathering intelligence and those sorts of things. So I think we need to be able to protect against it, and it's probably going to be more submarines providing the ASW capability. Of course, though, the aircraft provide that. There's an ad for the Royal Australian Air Force and their new capabilities, but also some of the Navy surface ships and that submarine capability. If I look at submarines, I don't know where we're going to buy it from, and there's lots of hints. What I see is the essential nature of the submarine capability for Australia in the future is most likely to be that it will contain a US combat system. And if we're to know how to use that and to use it well and use it in an interoperable way with our major ally, the United States, and in this case the US Navy, I reckon that a combined, integrated ASW Centre of Excellence is a really good idea.
I think there's another sort of broader point about centres of excellence and the role that Australia can play in the US-Australia alliance, but more broadly across the region, which is from a, and I don't especially like this term, I apologise, but from a thought leadership perspective. So we shouldn't overlook the extent to which our ability to convene people in something of a neutral space and talk about potentially contentious issues in ways that benefit us in terms of the normative system that we promote throughout the region is critically important to securing our vital interests. So these are relatively inexpensive investments. If we do it well, we don't want to become like center of excellence central and just every time we throw out a center of excellence or something. But in critical areas like ASW, I think it's a good investment to make.
Thanks. Okay, in the far back corner there, please. And then I'll come to this gentleman here.
Thank you. Elsina Wainwright, Centre on International Cooperation in New York University. Thank you very much to the panel for a very interesting discussion. I was pleased to hear Robert Hill mention defence budgets. Could we hear a bit more, please, from General Gregson and Ben Fitzgerald about the challenge of declining military budgets that you both mentioned, and particularly the threat of continuing sequestration and the uncertainties of defence planning. I think Secretary Hagel said last week this was the greatest threat which was facing the US military. We heard some optimistic assessments this morning about the potential for sequestration to be softened or repealed, but I'd love your views on the impact it's had in the Asia-Pacific theatre thus far, and has it been less than in potentially in other regions? Thank you.
Start with you, Chip, if we could.
Let me attack the easy target first. Sequestration is an absolutely dumb way to do things. The law mandated 10% cuts across the board. Shortly after that law passed, Admiral Jonathan Greenert, the Chief of Naval Operations, was castigated because he couldn't deploy an aircraft carrier. What do you mean you can't deploy an aircraft carrier? Well, taking 10% of some things makes it critical. And finally got that corrected, but it's still a machine that's running by itself, and there's not the thought needed behind it. Secondly, we developed some habits over the last 15 years with overseas contingency operating budgets so that basically it was, I won't say unlimited, but it was constantly rising budgets. If you could prove that people were going to die if we didn't have capability X, you got the money to get capability X, and it went that way. What happened is that we're now in a situation where we've got to start thinking seriously about strategy. In other words, ends, what are we trying to do, ways, how are we going to do it, and the means, what the resources are that are necessary to do it. And clearly you can't do everything, so some choices have to be made. We went through the Cold War with a villain right out of central casting. The Soviet Union was the enemy. It drove the thought process in the Pentagon. It drove the acquisition process. Everything was geared to what the Soviet capabilities were. We had a little bit of a holiday in the 1990s, and then with the 9/11 and all the things that transpired after that, we came very close to trying to fit terrorism into the new model of the designated enemy. And that doesn't work. We're facing a situation, as I said earlier, that is unprecedented, at least in modern American thinking, where we have a country that is a major economic partner of all of us in this room, but is also the source of some bone-deep security threats, and we have to rethink what deterrence means now. I would vote for quiet deterrence. We don't need to be particularly demonstrative about it, but we have to develop the capabilities that allow us to achieve doubt in the minds of those within China that would like to see a more hostile relationship. We're not trying to pick a fight with China. China, for one thing, has a vast geographic sanctuary. China also has nuclear weapons, so a first conclusion should be that regime change is out of the question, which should lead you to the second conclusion that what's important to us is to ensure that, A, the situation does not turn hostile, and B, if it does turn hostile, that what's important to us are the territory, the interest, and the lives of our allies and friends, which means we have a number of areas to defend out there. We've got 10,000 islands between the Philippines and Japan, for one, and I don't know how many you get when you get down to Indonesia and things. But there's a strategy that suggests itself here that can fit into this quiet deterrence type thing that's not provocative. And this also fits into the ASW question that we can be quite candid about developing the ASW capability. That'd be a good thing for people to know that we're doing. But we need to have the context built behind it that we favor China's successful rise and reintegration into the international system. We see no reason why the relationship should be hostile, et cetera, et cetera. We have as many positive conversations as we can with China at as high a decibel level as we can to put the more difficult things into context. But we have to achieve some sort of clarity to both sort out the defense budget and what's really important to us and what we need and what our strategic concept is in Asia, and also that a valid, coherent strategic concept would also go a long way towards reassuring our allies and friends on what exactly it is we're trying to do and how to fashion these goals so it's compatible with the policy goals of Australia and the policy goals of all our other allies and friends.
Thank you. Robert?
Well, I agree with all of that. But in addition to that, policymakers have to remember that there are very long lead times in defense, building defense capability, and a very bad thing for policymakers to chop and change on the money side. If you chop and change budgets, it is impossible to develop the long-term capabilities that you need to fit the long-term strategic policy that hopefully you've made. And the other thing policymakers need to remember is it is also unhelpful to be unrealistic, to expect that you can achieve certain capabilities that are simply not going to be achieved within the funding envelope that you are providing. And that's been a major mistake that's been made in Australia and in recent years, and it It's unhelpful. It leads to sort of instability and uncertainty. And it's some of those things that we're trying to clean out, aren't we, Peter, with our review.
That's right. So the thing I'd add, and truth in advertising here, I've been hanging out with Chip for almost a decade at this point, so there's a certain similarity in our answers at times, but which means we're both right, of course. I think going to Hegel's comments about risk, the risk for me is more about the uncertainty than the actual budget decrease. There are issues, don't get me wrong, there are significant issues associated with budget decreases, but it's the uncertainty that's killing us. It means that you can't plan. It impacts readiness in not necessarily well-understood ways. Associated with the inability to plan means you can't invest, and you can't provide a clear demand signal to industry and to your partners so that they can make their own investments to develop capability over time. On the Australian side, I think the critically important thing is that we maintain this reputation for carrying our own weight and for paying our way. We don't want to be seen in the sort of European light, even though I agree with some of the earlier comments that we're not necessarily paying our way to the extent that we could. We don't want to get into that position. More broadly, I think that we need to accept that in the short term, we can see that our budgets are decreasing in real terms. We also, and that may change over the coming years, but over the medium to long term, we need to understand that U.S. and Australian defense budgets in relative terms are going to be significantly less than what we're used to in terms of their power through the 20th century. And that's going to be relative to the myriad other actors in aggregate and some certain specific nations. And also from a technology and capability perspective, relative to private sector budgets in terms of research and development, in terms of access to new and emerging technologies. So all of this should be a catalyst for reform. And you'll see my old boss, Bob Work, as the Deputy Secretary of Defense, has announced this whole Defense Innovation Initiative. I think, again, I've worked with Bob for a while, so I think he's very much on the money. All of this should be a catalyst for reform, but it requires reform in an area that's certainly on the American side, and I think also on the Australian side, is the one area that we're least comfortable reforming. We're very comfortable coming out with new doctrine, new policies, but it's very difficult for us to reform the institutions. So when Chip talks about ends, ways, means, you'll see that most of the conversation about sequestration has been, well, how do we have fewer ends or less means? And no one's looking at, well, what are the ways? And so it's a somewhat boring, but I think critically important sort of call for institutional reform in ways that we haven't seen in a meaningful way in a very long time.
Thank you. Okay, we're quickly running out of time, but we've got two final questions. The gentleman right there, and then the gentleman in the far back. We'll collect those two questions, and then we'll turn to the panel. Yes.
Thank you. Lieutenant Colonel Scott McDonald, headquarters of the United States Marine Corps. This panel has spent a lot of time saying what Australia needs to do to make the alliance better. But seems to me in Southeast Asia and Oceania, the leadership, experience, and familiarity, Australia is a natural lead. I didn't appreciate your thoughts on what the United States could be doing to be a better alliance partner in the region with Australia. Thank you.
Thank you. And then the gentleman in the back, we'll collect the two together.
Thank you. This might be a complimentary question to the question just posed. I'm Lauren Hershey. I'm a former member of the Department of Justice and was a guest scholar here 30 years ago. But I do follow Asia-Pacific matters since 1966. That's another story. My question to Australians, what do you do with a few other countries? The India-Australia initiative is quite interesting. What about Indonesia? What about Singapore? What about Vietnam? Just to pick out three. Thank you.
Okay, inevitably the big questions come at the very end when we just got 5 minutes left. So just kind of short, pithy responses you might have to expectations from the U.S. and some of the other partners in the Asia-Pacific. Peter, why don't we start with you?
I'd keep doing what you're doing. Seriously, I think it's a very valuable relationship. At times, and we've heard the term burden sharing, and I can recall I was Chief of Army for 6 years, and most of that was during Iraq and Afghanistan. I think you were tolerant of us, accommodating of us. At times it was embarrassing that we weren't able to offer more, and at times it was quite embarrassing that we perhaps pulled our punches, and I'm thinking of things around Baghdad and we were down in the south. So I think your level of tolerance, the cooperation, the interoperability, I can't think of many things where I'd say, you're doing this wrong, do something more. It would be around ration packs, and you just can't eat that shit.
Veggie omelet. Always avoid the veggie omelet.
But essentially, I think what we have in the partnership from Australia to the United States is something very special, something that we value. Just quickly, in terms of India, we've talked a bit about India today. I do think that India is very important. I think globally we've tended to neglect India. From an Australian point of view, we think we have a special relationship because they play cricket too and we beat them. That's not enough. We have to understand them economically. We have to understand their problems with their nuclear neighbour to the west, and they're very distracted by that. Their nuclear neighbour to the north, and I think we have to understand that. But we do need to get much closer to Indonesia, rather to India, and I think we can do that as they're looking to come forward and to try and do a bit of what China's done and help the millions and millions of poor people that they've got there and develop the country. Indonesia, we're just seeing a new president there. I think he's getting to know the country. We have to get to know him. I think Indonesia is probably the most important relationship that Australia will have into the future. They do cover that sweet spot in geography, those sea lines of communications and the strategic choke points. They're a growing economy. They are a leader in ASEAN. But their focus is to the north and to other places rather than Australia. And so I think it's incumbent upon us to get closer to them and to support them as they go through what I think will be some difficult times. And just quickly, one clear example of that is, excuse me, there's a thing called the Jakarta Centre for Law Enforcement Cooperation. And that's essentially our federal police and other support, supporting Indonesia in the development of their police forces and their counter-terrorism force. And that's the sort of thing we can do, provide technical assistance and allow Indonesia to get on and do the job.
Thank you. We're just out of time, but any final short comments?
Yeah, I think what can the US do that would help us better? I think there still needs to be changes in the access to defence industry in this country, the supply chains, and some of it is cultural, some of it is actually still law. You know, we do need, if you want us to be a good, reliable partner, we only have a small defence industry, but we do need to be able to sustain that. The most sensible way to sustain that is to be able to sell into the US supply chains. Otherwise, there was a time when we would have called for greater transparency, but nowadays that's changed pretty much with the access of our people into your commands and so forth. We appreciate that you can be tolerant, that we operate under different rules, different laws, so we have different rules of engagement, but yet have still been able to work side by side. So I don't think there's, you know, we're very appreciative, as I said, that you've invested so much in the Asia-Pacific region for so long, which has enabled us to grow wealthy and successful. So on top of that, it would be pretty hard to demand more. On the three countries, we provide enormous amount to Singapore in terms of its defence capabilities, basing support, exercises, whatever they want, really, they can take, and they often do. So, you know, they're a partner, and sometimes a demanding partner, but they're important. Indonesia, I just agree with what Peter said. Indonesia is complex but very important. We have our differences from time to time, but they're not a threat. We want to be supportive of Indonesia as it grows politically and economically in every way, which is very challenging for them, but they've made great strides in the last 10 to 20 years. And Vietnam, we're an important economic partner, and we're becoming closer to them all of the time in terms of security policy as well. When they're upset about China, I reckon they were knocking on our doors as quickly as they were knocking on the doors in Washington.
And yeah, that works out. Yeah. Wonderful. Why don't we go ahead and wrap it up there? Please join me in thanking the excellent panel today.
successful day, and thank you for those of you who kept asking great questions right up until the end. I just want to point to a few points from today's discussion that I think really stood out for me. First and foremost, I think from panel two, was the shocking revelation that until 2006, our former Prime Minister John Howard had remained completely immune to the cultural legacy of Arnold Schwarzenegger, which is something that I think